Good evening. This is the September meeting of the County of San Luis Obispo Health Commission. And I'd like to welcome our guests. As the first order of business, I'd like to introduce our new health commissioners, Ms. Debbie Donnelly, RN, and Dr. James Massey. And welcome. Okay, next order of business is the approval of the minutes. We need to approve both the June 13th and the August 8th minutes, August 8th being our retreat, Health Commission retreat. Are there any corrections or additions to the minutes of June 13th? Dr. Pinkel.
Thank you. I expressed a concern at our retreat about TRICARE. For those who don't know, TRICARE is a health plan that is sponsored by our DOD for military and for the families of military on active duty, and also for retired members of the military and their families. And what I have discovered is that many physicians in this county will not accept TRICARE. And there are instances where there are people that must leave our county to get care. Now, I don't know how much there is to this, but I would think that we need to move that up on the agenda and discuss it. As far as VA health care, that's a totally different subject. And the last I've heard is that the VA has received more funding for their health care program. Thank you.
Dr. Pinkel, I wasn't at the June meeting. Was that discussed at June meeting?
No, July in the retreat. No, August in the
retreat. I'm sorry, the July meeting. I wasn't, yeah.
Yeah. In August, we
didn't have
discussing the agenda for future meetings, and
right,
I brought up
right.
TRICARE,
right.
And I don't see that on the agenda for future meetings.
I see. I understand. Okay.
So I just wanted to explain again.
Okay, but you did mention it, so we'll amend the August minutes
right.
to reflect your comments.
Right. Yep. Thank
okay.
you very much.
So, but I was on the June minutes, if we could get through those. Did you have a correction for those, Pam?
No, I wasn't here at the June, but I think Dr. Pinkel's referring to at the last page of the minutes from the August 8th retreat on the January title should be VA TRICARE, not VA hospital care.
No,
it's
not VA. It's military.
Okay. How about the June 13th minutes? Does anybody have any corrections or addition to those minutes?
Second.
Any discussion or objections? Okay. The minutes then will stand as written on June 13th. Now, how about August 8th? Dr. Pinkel has already noted an addition that when we discuss the goals and objectives for this coming year for the Health Commission, the subjects of the meetings, that we include TRICARE. And apparently you had said that in addition to the veterans care or not
well, I didn't
no
have
veterans,
veterans
care. You didn't bring up the veterans care. Okay.
TRICARE.
Okay. TRICARE. Are there any other additions or corrections to the August 8th minutes? Okay. There being no further corrections or additions and no objection, the minutes of August 8th will stand as corrected. Thank you. Okay, now we come to the public comment section. And I believe we have people who want to make a public comment. This is now, they may make a comment in 3 minutes in length about a subject that is not on our agenda tonight. Joel? When you come up, if you would please sign your name on the podium and say your name.
Good evening, members of the Commission. My name is Joel Derringer. I'm a member of the First Five Commission. as well as a board member of the Children's Health Initiative of San Luis Obispo. I wanted to bring you first some very good news, which you may have been reading about in the paper, and that's that the Children's Health Initiative has begun enrollment and actual coverage of uninsured children in the county. As of the beginning of September, I believe we've enrolled about 120 children into the new Healthy Kids product. As you may know, the goal of the Children's Health Initiative is to eliminate the rate of uninsured children in the county, both through getting those who are eligible for but not enrolled in Medi-Cal and Healthy Families enrolled in those programs, as well as providing health coverage to children under 300% of the poverty level. So we've had a wonderful success in getting that rolling and have begun enrolling children. The second thing is we have another wonderful opportunity, which I want to ask your support for, on a statewide level. We've been working hard at a local level, as have been about 20 other counties, to provide coverage. But in reality, for this to be sustainable over the long term, we need the support of the state. The legislature has recently acted, and both houses have passed AB 772, and I should say with the support of Senator Maldonado, which would phase in a program over the next 3 years to provide universal coverage for children in California. The bill is going before the governor, who has until October 9th to act on it. Both the First Five Commission and the Children's Health Initiative Board have written letters in support of the bill, and I want to urge you as the Health Commission to do so as well. I have a brief outline of the bill, and I think there are copies that are in your packet already. And I just want to urge you, I don't know if it would be too late to agendize it for the October meeting, and I'm not sure that you could do it today under the Brown Act, but I do want to encourage you, either as a commission or individually, to write the governor to sign the bill. We're really at a critical juncture and an exciting opportunity in California to provide health coverage for all children, and it's doable, and I think that we should all support the governor and have him do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we ask questions?
I guess so.
Go ahead.
Joel, I have one question. And I know this has been covered before, and my old brain hasn't retained it. Does this health care cover a dental for children?
Yes, it covers medical, dental, and vision.
Thank you.
Okay, next.
Good evening. My name is Mark Phillips. I'm with SLOGE Free. And several months ago, I presented a resolution to the Board of Supervisors asking them to support legislation efforts to label GE food. I was told by them to bring the matter to the GE Task Force committees because they had been specifically set up to address GE issues. Bob Milley stated the Ag Task Force would not address labeling, so that left only the Health Commission's GE Task Force. During the August Task Force meeting, now I'm speaking only of the Health Commission's Task Force meeting, I presented the argument that labeling of GE food was a matter that pertained to public health. Should a problem with GE food develop, or indeed if there already is one, it will be much easier to identify the culprit if these foods are labeled. It could also serve to exonerate GE food as a suspect. Either way, it would benefit public health if labeling were mandated, as it is in many countries, including most of Europe. I have submitted today the statement that I made at that GE Task Force meeting, and along with this one. I was making the argument that doing nothing is de facto support for the status quo, and as such benefits the GE industry, when I was told by the chair, Lynn Enns, that the GE Task Force would not take a position on labeling one way or another. Thinking that this was exactly what this GE task was supposed to do, I asked how the legislative committee would know how to proceed regarding labeling of GE food if they did not get any advice from the committee that is looking into this issue in depth, and I got no answer on that. Essentially, I was told that these were the rules and that was that. I was told that the GE task force would advise the Board of Supervisors that no opinion regarding labeling would be forthcoming from the task force and that their full report would be submitted in the spring, some 6 months away. When I asked if the portion of the report concerning labeling could be parsed out ahead of that date, I was told that could not happen. When I tried to contact the legislative committee via the public health department, I was told that they did not have a chair nor any immediate plans to meet. I would appreciate some direction from the health commission as to how to proceed. In particular, I would hope that you will sense my frustration at a system that currently is asking me to wait 6 months for a report that will have no recommendations regarding labeling of GE food before I can resume this issue with the County Board of Supervisors. In addition, current legislation under consideration by the California Legislature requires prompt attention by the Health Commission Legislative Committee. Please advise when we will be able to discuss with them State Bill 1056. In an effort to understand the rules that made no sense to me, I tried to get in touch with the individuals involved in their creation. I was told that the task force rules were provided by three individuals, Debbie O'Brien, David O'Dell, and Jan Hicks. I've tried several avenues to contact these individuals, but so far without success. I'm pretty sure they know I'm trying to get in touch with them. And while asking them about the rationale for the rules that preclude forming opinions, I would also like to ask them about the selection process used to select the task force members. It appears that some applicants were not allowed a seat on the task force if they were in favor of Measure Q, but that those who were opposed to Measure Q were allowed to sit on the committee. In fact, Scott Steinmuss, who is the assistant chair or something like that, vice chair, wrote the argument against Measure Q for the ballot initiative. If this impression is not correct, then those involved should be only too happy to clear the matter up. Continued resistance to addressing
Mr. Phillips, your 3 minutes is up. Thank you very much.
Continued resistance will only contribute to public skepticism.
Thank you for your comments.
Hi, Chairwoman Enns and the Health Commission. I'm sorry, this is more of the same on the same subject. My name is Elizabeth Johnson, and I reside in San Luis Obispo. I'm a visual artist and volunteered without pay in the campaign to pass Measure Q last year. I am not now being paid by any group or individual for my views. I'd like to commend the Health Commission on the overall quality of their recent pesticide report, and that will not be said of any report by the so-called GMO task force. This committee so obviously favors a pro-GE position that the concerns about safety of genetically engineered food, voiced by over 43,000 county voters last year, are effectively silenced. I'm here today as an advocate for that public and for the 92% of Americans who want scientific and medical studies to prove in independent labs that GE foods are safe. We want at least one long-term, multi-generational study with scientific controls. I'm certainly not asking this Health Commission to conduct such a study, but I am asking this body to note health concerns by first-rate international geneticists, which I've given you as a handout, and address them professionally in an unbiased way. The GMO Task Force was formed for such an inquiry. However, it is not able to set aside its agenda to promote GE crops, much less deal with health questions. At the end of last Tuesday's meeting, I asked several of the individuals and if they know who chose the task force. And
Your 3 minutes is up. Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Are you certain? Because I timed it several times.
No. Okay, my mistake. Okay, you have 1.5 minutes more. Sorry.
Each individual said they did not know how the task force was formed, but in the April 11th record from this commission clearly states who selected the group. In her April 20 notes from the Farm Bureau, Jackie Crabb wrote, "We feel they have chosen a fair and balanced committee and direction." In its present form, the GMO Task Force defies the ethics of transparency in government bodies. The public is rightly uneasy, for it has no paid lobbyists or deep pockets to fund political action. We ask the Health Commission to provide minimal protection of our interests by ensuring that representatives on the GMO Task Force reflect a balance of community concerns and positions on GE safety issues. Therefore, I respectfully ask the Health Commission to consider three options in dealing with a task force that is functioning as a special interest group. Number one, disband it immediately based on its overwhelmingly biased membership. Number two, remove the Health Commission sponsorship and suggest that the meetings be held at the Farm Bureau. Number three, disband the task force and create a new, transparent, and more representative group that clearly has its priorities in public health issues. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
Okay. I agree 100% with you, Mrs. Johnson, and I think that the action ought to be taken along the lines that you suggest. And I'm in favor of GE, but I'm in favor of it also being regulated, because GE is a very powerful tool and I've had personal experience with it for 20 years. And I think that what needs to be done is to get a meaningful task force that will come up with recommendations as to how it might be regulated most easily and most conveniently. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Pinkel. Commissioner Hetherington?
I'm going to agree with what Dr. Pinkel said. I'm really disappointed that the task force is coming under fire. Having done the pesticide task force over the past many years, even though there was some controversy, you know, there was never anybody coming to the meeting saying that, you know, there's something going on that is not transparent. So for me, that's a red flag. And I think that next month we are to discuss an update of that task force, that we should devote enough time to work through this, because the worst thing I think that can happen is that the Health Commission come out with no recommendation and no saying on what you've been doing for the last many, 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 many months. So.
Thank you. Since I'm the chair of the GE task force, I will simply say that I'm going to comment on this later in my report. Commissioner Hale.
I don't remember the task force being set up to address specifically GE Foods like these two people were talking about tonight. I remember it being more to do with the agricultural component of it, because the people who were on the committee did not, or at least when, if I remember right, when it was started, I mean, I don't remember the specifics of exactly who decided who's going to be on it, but I do remember the ground rules of how it was being set up. It wasn't to talk about GE Foods. It was more to talk about the agricultural issues of growing genetically engineered crops in San Luis Obispo County. It didn't talk about labeling foods and the food aspect specifically. If I remember right, our idea at that time was to go ahead and let this run its process, and then we can talk about GE Foods if we want to, or you know, what other aspects of genetic engineering. But at least that's my understanding, is that it wasn't set up to talk about labeling and those kinds of things.
Like I said, I'll comment on when I give my report later. Okay, do we have any other? Oh, there we are. Please. State your name.
Okay. My name is Teresa Campbell, and I'm here tonight as a concerned parent. My daughter is taking AP Biology this year, and during back-to-school night, I discovered that part of the AP curriculum is participation in a genetic engineering laboratory experiment. The students will use a safe E. coli breakdown its plasmid with heat, introduce ampicillin-resistant marker genes into the bacteria, and in this way, a student can tell with the application of the antibiotic if the genetic engineering was successful. This type of experimentation has been on the AP curriculum for many years, and I wonder if health departments all over the country are aware of this. Having high school students come in contact with antibiotic-resistant material seems risky, especially when so many antibiotics are being rendered useless for various reasons, and antibiotic-resistant diseases are on the rise. E. coli is another red flag, although we have there are harmless E. colis, of course. Joe Cummins, a professor emeritus at University of Western Ontario, refers to a landmark Dutch study from 1991 when thinking about this topic. It surprised scientists by discovering that their lab coats were routinely contaminated by genetically modified material, bacteria, which often also penetrated to the clothes underneath. He said the kids could carry this into the environment on their hands and clothes, and yet the antibiotic-resistant trait could persist in their bodies for years. There's no way young kids should be exposed to that resistant marker gene. And he said high school students' biotech experiments are all too common example of the lax attitudes of scientists and public officials toward the horde of genetically modified bacteria and viruses being engineered in labs around the world. He said this is typical of much of Canadian biotechnology. It tends to be wildly careless. The disposal of the material into the environment is another safety question. The MSDS info I have on the experiment says to follow federal, state, and local regulations, and you know, I don't know what those are. My daughter's biology teacher just follows the instructions on the sheet that she gets. I think parents are not being adequately informed about the risks of this lab work. The biotech industry has a history of just putting stuff in our lives without asking or informing, as was the case when Americans learned they had been eating genetically engineered food for years without knowing genetic engineering existed. Many parents wouldn't know to question this lab experiment. We're all concerned that our children learn what they need in AP biology, but I think parents need to know exactly what their kids are working with and what their options are. Schools are in a difficult position when doing their job might mean putting kids in a risky situation. I'm grateful that my daughter's principal and biology teacher are willing to work with me and let her do a dry lab instead of coming in contact with materials. So I would ask the health department to take an interest in the subject and make sure that the school districts know the federal, state, and local regulations for safety protocol in this coursework. The health department should also instruct school districts to provide risk and safety information about this coursework because parents have the right to know. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Commissioner Pinkel.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Are you aware as to whether this is known to OSHA? Because OSHA usually has something to say about what goes on in laboratories in terms of safety.
This is just all new to me. Back to school night just occurred, and I've been trying to find out. There are a lot of schools get a lot of the kits from different companies. Each one has their own instruction sheets. The one that my school uses, it just said follow state, local, and federal regulations.
That's interesting.
I don't know about.
Some interest is that there was an article I was reading this afternoon in Lancet that there is an epidemic in England of resistant E. coli. You wonder how these things get.
Yeah.
it happens, of course, in hospital.
Mm-hmm. So it just seems like, you know, with all of that running around, that it might be something that at least I feel like parents should know that their kids could be coming in contact with.
I think it's rather young for them to be dealing with it. That's sort of graduate school work.
AP biology is, they get college credit for it, but nevertheless, they do have the option to do what they call dry lab or virtual online or just observe the teacher. And so my teacher is willing to do that, and I think parents should know. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Hetherington?
My question is for Dr. Thomas. What do you know about this?
First, I've been told of the use of this. I'll talk to the County Office of Education, and if Ms. Campbell would tell me what school district her daughter is in, I'll do some looking into it.
Yeah, I think that's very important, especially, you know, if they're referring to other guidelines that maybe aren't in the packets, you know, that there should be a audit trail on those types of substances. Thanks, Dr. Thomas.
Thank you. Are there any other people desiring to speak in the public comment period? Okay, that being the case, there are none. We'll move on to our presentation on obesity in San Luis Obispo County. We have with us this evening several presenters, and I think I'll just turn it over to you to go from here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good evening, members of the commission. You know how to do it. Good, thank you. This is a collection of people who are actively working with obesity at the moment in our county. As you can see from the agenda, is it not working? Thank you. That's already better. I can feel it. Okay. As you can see from the agenda, there's several of us who are going to be speaking. I'm giving an overview. We also have background information, but then also examples of ongoing programs in our county. Now I have to make the program work. My name is Amy Gilman. Now we're in position. As you can see from our title, the previous title, we're looking at obesity prevention. We'll talk a lot about obesity, but it's not only about obesity. It's about the long-term effects of acquiring obesity and being obese, particularly in your later years. This starts in childhood, but we'll get to that. Among adults, the long-term consequences of a poor diet and lack of physical activity are cardiovascular disease, diabetes, some cancers, high blood pressure, breathing problems, arthritis, reproductive complications, and certainly from diet and lack of exercise is the overweight and obesity itself. There's an estimated 300,000 deaths per year attributable to obesity and its comorbidities at the national level. And the increase of premature death increases with increasing weight gain, particularly in adulthood. For obese persons, and we'll get to some definitions in a moment, premature death risk is up to 100% greater than a person of a healthy weight. Among children, we've been seeing an increased amount of what were typically adult problems at an increasingly younger age. High cholesterol, high blood pressure, and certainly type 2 diabetes has actually increased dramatically over the last years. Furthermore, again, when we're preventing chronic disease, overweight adolescents have an 70 to 80% chance of becoming overweight or obese adults. So it's a process that accumulates over time. Backwards. All right, now I've got it under control now. Certainly, there's also economic considerations. The total cost of obesity in the U.S. In 2000 was $117 billion. Among children, as children become more and more obese, those costs are increasingly being tracked, and annual hospital costs for children and adolescents due to obesity was $120 million, and that's an increase from $35 million 20 years ago. Specifically in California, the cost in 2000 for inactivity, obesity, and overweight was nearly $22 billion. And this is in healthcare, workers' compensation, and lost productivity. So quite a sizable amount of money. Obesity in general, and you've known it all your lives, obesity, overweight and obesity occurs due to excessive calorie intake and low, inadequate physical activity. In fact, as people get more involved in trying to understand weight gain, it's quite complex. Initially, there's your genetics and your metabolism, but certainly environmental, behavioral, cultural, and socioeconomic factors influence how you eat, exercise, and process food. From a public health perspective, obviously social and environmental factors are large contributors. These factors influence you throughout your life, starting from birth. In utero, you are certainly given your starting genes. I didn't set it on automatic. It's jumping ahead by itself. You have your genetic expression from both your parents, but your maternal environment, her metabolic and what she actually does actually greatly influence you during your own fetal period. That, in theory, sets your stage to how your body's going to deal with weight. But once you're born, you are then influenced by societal and environmental factors, cultural factors that then contribute to how you eat and exercise. At birth, low and high birth weight babies are at greater risk of adolescent and adult obesity and chronic disease. And then in infancy, factors such as whether you breastfeed are important. Breastfed babies have less risk of later obesity. In infancy, it's also when babies or young children are being trained to how they eat. And those habits are really initiated early and set the tone for how that child person will eat food. In infancy, also low birth weight babies are at greater risk of later obesity if their catch-up growth is too excessive, it's too accelerated, they're at greater risk of later obesity. After infancy, probably the kids are starting to watch more TV. Well, maybe not by age two, but increasingly they're influenced by TV and advertisement and becoming more part of the family environment. Maybe there's less time concentrated on taking care of the child. They're watching more TV. They're becoming less active. They're also demanding those foods they see on TV when they go to the store. So an increasing process of being active in their own weight gain, if you will. And so by teenage, they possibly are overweight or obese. And then by adulthood, they are possibly still gaining weight. But at that point, overweight teens have become mothers, and they in turn are likely to give birth to a high-weight baby, particularly if they are diabetic themselves, if they have excessive weight gain during pregnancy, enter the pregnancy at an overweight state. So then they have their own overweight baby or high-weight baby, which is greater than 4,000 grams, and it starts a cycle again. So each baby's born with its own in theoretical growth pattern, but then that's influenced by society. Keeps the life cycle. Keeps going around. Public health and certainly the Surgeon General and CDC are calling this an epidemic of epidemic proportions. In the past 10 years, obesity rates have increased by more than 60% among adults. And since 1980, that's only 25 years ago now, obesity rates have doubled among children and tripled among adolescents. Interesting, 15% of children and adolescents 6 to 19 years are 15% are considered overweight. Our data actually shows a different picture, but. And then as an epidemic, the increases in the prevalence of overweight obesity cuts across all ethnicity, age groups, and gender. There are a few differences, but everybody has experienced an increase in their ethnic group. Nationally, since 1991, CDC's, not since 1991, been making the maps, but data presented from 1991 shows a dramatic increase in blue states. It's not politics in this case, but it's this is the percentage of states that have a fifth or a quarter of their people being overweight. This is adults, and overweight is being termed as BMI greater than 25, body mass index, which is just to refresh you, is in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. And this renders then a number. Normal weight for adults, normal body mass index for adults is 18.5 to 25, 24.9. And then overweight is considered between 25 and 30. And obese is greater than 30. Very obese is greater than 35, BMI greater than 35. So this, these maps show that California has become a blue state, which despite our long history of sunshine and fun, we hadn't realized we had a problem in California. But we're now up there with the top 20 states. In our county specifically, we as adults, we actually compare with adults for California as a whole, about 55%. Among, then if we jump, so adults then to birth, We have in our county from, based upon data from 2003, 80% of our babies fall in the healthy range. 6.6 were low birth weight, and 11.7 were high birth weight babies. That's greater than 4 kilos, 4,000 grams. It's a lot. 8.13 pounds. Then if we move to our next category of available data, we have the Head Start program, the WIC program, and the CHDP, Children's Health and Disability Prevention Program. These, we should note, target lower income, and it's not necessarily the universal population. However, it's the rates for children 3 to 5 who are at risk of overweight, which is the height for weight for height for their age category between the 85th and 95th percentile, is already a staggering basically 17%. By the time you include the kids who are technically already overweight by age 3 and 5, we have in the Head Start, it's 43%. WIC is just behind it. Again, this is a lower income population, and so may not necessarily indicate what all 3 to 5 year old children in our county look like. However, that was my mistake. By fifth grade, which is then where our next data comes from Department of Education's state website. They have an annual physical fitness test, and for what they post on the website is fifth grade, seventh grade, ninth grade. For the fifth graders in the year 2003-2004, our fifth graders, you can see by the blue line to the right, they're just under 32%. So, in fact, while we see for 3 to 5 year old children quite a high rate, it nearly is universal, as the school-age children, the school data is universal data, except for homeschool kids. Am I going too fast? Okay. Otherwise, from this slide, you can see a comparison of San Luis Obispo County with the state. The state from this data shows a slight decrease, while San Luis shows a lower prevalence across the three age groups, and only the fifth graders are showing an increase. I don't know if I'll swear by this data. I shouldn't say that because it's what we have, but it'll be interesting to see how it looks after we continue to work with the data and work with children. But again, from this data, we can see across the three grade levels, each one has a problem. The blue bars on the left for San Luis County represent females, and there's certainly a less prevalence of being at risk of overweight or overweight compared to males. But even amongst them, it's 20%, if not greater than 20%, across the fifth, seventh, and ninth grades. In the graph to the right, Latino populations have a greater prevalence. In fifth grade, Latinos, 43.5, and what is considered white is 26%. At risk or overweight. This is the technically obesity data, and then we also have data that for the main contributing factors on what are kids doing, so what's the physical activity level. From data in 2001, unfortunately this hasn't been repeated in more recent surveys. This is coming from the California Health Interview Survey from UCLA. The graph on the left is for TV use, and the graph on the right is computer use, and that's 2 hours or more per weekday, not the weekend days, the weekdays. So we have 58% of our 3 to 11-year-olds are watching more than 2 hours of TV a day. And that's nearly 60% for the 12 to 18-year-olds. It's slightly better than California. Computer use, we actually use the computer a hair more in our younger age group, the 3 to 11-year-olds. But both our county and California, quite a lot of sitting and watching TV and playing video games. Team sports, we compared to California as a whole, we do a little bit better. More of our children are in 1 to 2 teams or 3 or more teams of team sports in the past 12 months. Again, this is from 2001 for teenage kids. And this is from a self-reported survey that's conducted through the schools on a 2-year basis, every 2 years. Seventh graders and ninth graders report about 80%, just over 80%, that they have had moderate activity at least 3 times in the past 7 days. And moderate activity includes sweating and heavy breathing for at least 20 minutes, actually less than what we know the Surgeon General recommends of us. By 11th grade, when school regulations change, it drops down to about 70%. Our level of activity then contributes to, again, that same physical fitness test, and they have 6 standards, one of which is the body composition, which we looked at earlier and forgot to explain. So this is percentage of the children achieving this 6 of the 6 fitness standards. And compared to California, we are doing much better. Our fifth graders took a serious dive, though, between 2002 and 2003. California as a whole is improving. San Luis looks like it's stagnating. So this is the percentage of kids who are considered fit. By sex and ethnicity, this is roughly the inverse of what we saw for the kids who were overweight. Males are less fit compared to girls, and Latinos are less fit than whites and African Americans. Which does make sense. We're learning from our parents in many ways. In 2003, the adults who acknowledged that they walked at least once in the past week for fun, exercise, or transport is 71% in our county. Once. Maybe that means they were playing basketball all other, 6 days of the week. And that data on physical fitness, it looks pretty good, actually. I mean, it's not the worst. But it seems a little bit incongruent with our increasing levels of being overweight and obese. But what we eat, it becomes quite clear. Breastfeeding starts off with a very good note. Compared to California, we initiate breastfeeding very well, 92.5%, and more than 80% continue to breastfeed up to the 6 months. This is among a general population survey done by WIC and Cal Poly. So it's quite good. But looking specifically at WIC infants who were actively participating in the infant feeding program, so the children that were given what they call a food instrument, this survey is those infants. So I imagine, in fact, while they say infants, it's less than kids less than 6 months. But
I like rocking in my chair.
Among those particular children participating in the WIC program, exclusively breastfed is down to 27, just under 28%. Formula-only infants was nearly 45%. So that's a very different picture among what technically is a different population. Again, breastfeeding certainly there's reasons for formula feeding, but breastfeeding does help decrease the rate of later obesity. Children 2 to 11 years old eating the 5 or more servings of fruits and vegetables looks like it's actually decreased for our county in a matter of 2 years, from nearly 47% down to 36%. This is among our youngest kids, 2 to 11 years old. Compared to California, we're under that compared to, and even considering our strong agriculture base here. It's about the same. On the left is again fruits and vegetables 5 times a day, but this is for again the 3 grade levels in school, 7th, 9th, and 11th, in for the past 24 hours. About 50% of our kids are getting the required 5 or more fruits and vegetables a day. Milk, less than that. We should be getting 3 servings of milk or other dairy per day. Less than 50% do. On the other hand, about 25% of our kids ate fried potatoes in the last 24 hours, 2 or more servings. 2 or more servings in the last 24 hours. And soda, that's nearly as good as fruits and vegetables, about 45% had 2 or more sodas in the last 24 hours. With age, the likelihood of eating breakfast decreases from about 70% in 7th grade down to about 58% in 11th grade. Eating breakfast certainly makes you more ready for school in a learning environment, being more actively ready to learn. But it also jumpstarts your metabolism and decreases the need then to do starvation lunch crash diet decreases the prevalence of obesity. Adults, again, we're teaching our children well. Adults eating 5-a-day fruits and veg or salad in the last week, about 55%. On the left is the fruits and veg servings, and about 60% of us have at least 3 salads in the last week. Because we have other programs that are going to be presenting, I didn't want to talk about a lot of our participation. We have the various programs going on. But one group that's not yet here but will be influenced by this is the food stamp program. And in our county, you can see a very strong north-south pull in the number of people requiring the food stamp program, and certainly they're behind efforts to improve the quality of food. Another area, very much again USDA funded, is schools that are supported through the free and reduced price breakfast and lunches. One of our presenters is from Lucia Mar School District, so I think she gets into that some more. But again, you can see North and actually Coast Unified is higher than expected, but San Miguel, Shandon, extremely high level of participation in these programs. But again, this gives us great opportunity. So, thank you.
Thanks. Our next speaker is, and I'm sorry, Amy, I didn't get to introduce you. I was getting information on the E. coli genetic experiment. Beth is going to Beth Suman is going to speak next. She is working on a temporary assignment with us on confronting obesity and working with the Gold Coast Collaborative. I think she'll say a few words about the Gold Coast Collaborative, but she's going to speak about the role of government and what have other counties done.
Okay. The role of government is actually kind of an interesting question. A lot of people question how can the government play any role in obesity and controlling people's weight. And it's often been looked at as a two-sided issue, one being that the government clearly can't control what people eat, how much people eat. and also when and how much people exercise. And at the same time, the result of the poor choices often people make as in those areas brings great public costs that government often absorbs. And so it kind of leaves people in civic leadership positions and with the responsibility not to impinge on civil rights and at the same time not to be an idle observer. And on the national level, there's been a response, and that's through the Healthy People 2010 document. I assume everybody's familiar with that document, being on the Health Commission, but basically it guides what the nation would like the health to be by the year 2010. And it has 10 leading health indicators, and one of those is physical activity, and another of those is overweight and obesity. From those leading health indicators are how their objectives are formed. And on the state level, many of you may also know that the governor is holding a childhood obesity summit this Friday in Sacramento, and out of that is expected to come some level of commitment from the governor's office and those in high-level positions. And also, a recent document from the Institute of Medicine identified government as playing a key role in obesity, in that they are in a key position to make the decisions on the state and local level specifically that are required in terms of confronting obesity and changing the tide of the epidemic. I'm going to speak on two groups that have been formed in two different counties in our state. And one is the San Diego County Coalition on Children and Weight. And this is a group that seems to be a mixture of what our county already has and maybe what our county would like to see. What our county already has is called the Gold Coast Collaborative, and we're part of a tri-county collaborative with Ventura County and Santa Barbara County. And it's a group of multidisciplinary participants ranging from physical activity to nutrition and, you know, from Cal Poly and RECs and public health and EOC. And it's a fairly active group in San Luis Obispo. We meet about monthly. And the group convenes on what's being done in this county from the community standpoint. And the difference between kind of Gold Coast Collaborative and this coalition is that this coalition was started with the county. It was their champion was the chairman of their board of supervisors, and he became that. Their champion from a presentation to the Health Commission, and it was established in January 2002. And like Gold Coast Collaborative, it brings together a really wide range of players from the county, from childcare to schools, rec departments, same thing as in our county, except their membership is actually 250, and ours is about 20. We're also a smaller county. But they also establish work groups, which are very active. That's different from ours, too. And I'm going to give you examples of their work groups. One is the School Nutrition Committee, and they work for education in schools for both kids and teachers to make better nutrition decisions. So being a county group, they can't lobby for any sort of nutrition law change, but they hope to achieve the same means by through education. The next work group is the Physical Activity Committee, and what they do is they ensure that physical activity standards are being met in the schools, and they also try to create and promote wider opportunities for physical activity. There's the Minority and Low Income Committee, and as has been published fairly widely, is that obesity and poor physical activity and nutrition are higher in low income groups than in higher income groups. The next group is the Family Involvement Committee, and basically their intention is to promote physical activity at all levels rather than just in schools or in childcare, but for it to be a very consistent message. And then lastly is the Breastfeeding Committee, and they support WIC and other breastfeeding programs and do education and promotion in hospitals. So those are just examples of what could come about through kind of a greater expansion of Gold Coast. The funding and coordination was originally coordinated by county and contract staff. I'm contract staff now. And through necessity, the responsibility shifted through a board and those elected from their membership base. Their funding was originally provided by the Board of Supervisors, and the funding shifted through partially the County Health Department. And a lot of the coalition work is conducted by volunteers, like all the work of the work groups. And they also seek donations locally. The San Francisco City and County has kind of taken a pioneer position in endorsing obesity prevention. They have just officially endorsed the Taking Action for a Healthier California, Recommendations to Improve Healthy Food and Activity Options. And this is a list of recommendations that was created by the Strategic Alliance. And it's a statewide coalition of nutrition professionals. And it's completely research-based. And basically what it is a list of 10 priority options that range from advertising to agriculture. So the good thing about it is it doesn't just focus on nutrition or physical activity or what can business do or what can public health do. It's everything. And when you kind of think about it, everything plays a role in creating this epidemic. The kind of endorsement of the plan makes the statement that, like I just said, that a lot of different facets of responsibility can work together to create healthier environments. I'll give you some examples of their recommendations. One is providing equitable access to public facilities. Like I said earlier, where obesity rates are higher amongst lower income groups, there's actually also lower opportunities for community-wide physical activity in lower income areas. And subsequently, there's also higher rates of chronic disease. Another example is adopting model worksite policies. So this includes healthy food and endorsing healthy food choices and physical activity, and also making breastfeeding accommodations in the workplace. Another one is improving access to healthy foods. There's been kind of what they describe supermarket flight, where in also lower income areas, there's not as many supermarkets and therefore not as many choices for healthy food. And at smaller neighborhood-run grocery stores, you often find not as many fruits and vegetables, and they also tend to be more expensive. The last one is implement farm-to-institution programs. I say last one on here, but there's actually 10 recommendations. This is to make fresh, local, and sustainable food that's grown locally available at schools, hospitals, and other institutions. And the great thing about taking action is that Strategic Alliance, who's officially come up with this plan, provides technical assistance to counties and cities and such that wish to implement it. And about community environment change, I think tobacco control is a great example of how health behavior has followed environment change. For example, not being able to smoke in restaurants and bars, and smoking rates going down. And addressing community environments seems to be becoming the kind of the pioneer way to make health behavior change.
So our next part, besides kind of laying the framework, giving you some statistical background and some information on the causes of obesity, the epidemic of obesity, then what have some local governments done? Our next step here is to take a few examples of what is going on in the community to work on the obesity epidemic, and then we'll conclude with what are some next steps? What at the Gold Coast Collaborative, what suggestions did we have to the Health Commission about next steps that we would ask of you, and then you may have some additional steps that you suggest as well. So Dana Ravlin works with Public Health and is a registered dietitian, and she's going to talk about some of her activities with us.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Good evening, everyone. Basically, what I want to do this evening is just give you a little bit more information about two specific activities in which I'm involved in through the Public Health Department. The first activity is through our Maternal, Child, and Adolescent Health Program. Part of the requirements of that program and to receive funding on a local level is that a strategic plan for 5 years is submitted to the state. Basically outlining how we're spending their money. And in that plan, we establish objectives with goals attached to them and how we are going to achieve those goals. One of our objectives in the plan that is currently in place is the first item on my overhead, and that directly relates to the reduction of childhood overweight in our community. And the objective is by June 30th of 2009, we are planning on decreasing the percentage of children over the 85th percentile BMI for age by 5%. That may not sound like a significant amount, but when you think about all the children in this county who are either currently overweight or at risk for being overweight, that's quite a number. Our target age group is children ages 3 to 5. We chose that group based on medical information that has been documented indicating these children are at greatest risk of continuing to be overweight and potentially obese as adults if they are already showing signs of overweight increase at this age. It's a very, very important time of growth and development. So we are specifically targeting that age group because of that risk. To just give you an insight as to the significance of this problem statewide, we shared this objective with 38 other counties in the state of California. It is widespread and significant. One of our first goals in our particular objective is to have established a working committee of community representatives to look at where we need to take our track, so to speak. And this group has basically decided that we do not have good baseline data in our county for this particular age range. As Amy had alluded to in the first presentation, we do have information regarding BMI, percentage of overweight for children in low-income populations. But that's not reflective of our entire county or representative of our county. So one of the first things we're going to do as a committee is actually go into preschool daycare environments and obtain BMIs. And we're trying to do that in a way that is not necessarily random, but all-encompassing. So we're trying to go into daycares where they're both being served low-income, middle-income, maybe high-income families, so we get a better range or a better idea of where we're at in this community. So that's our first goal, and we will begin collecting data hopefully in November of 2006. And we're looking to do this with volunteers from Cal Poly's kinesiology department. These particular students have been well-trained on gathering anthropometric data of adults as well as children, and also using volunteers from the Cal Poly's dietetic internship program. Thank you. So that's what we're doing in terms of the maternal child health program in addressing childhood overweight in our community. The other activity that I wanted to share with you is actually an activity that I do as part of public health. And this is where I provide individualized nutrition assessment and medical nutrition therapy for families of overweight children who have full scope Medi-Cal. These children are referred to me through private pediatricians in our county. Our CHDP program basically does a treatment authorization request from Medi-Cal for my services. And if my services are approved, the Medi-Cal program offers 90 minutes for me to see these children for their assessment, and then I receive 6 hours of therapy time for follow-up. Once that time has been exhausted, then we have to go back to the drawing board and re-request time again from Medi-Cal. For any of you that have ever battled weight or had any family members that have had weight problems, you can see that basically 7.5 hours of time is really not going to make much of a difference. But it's what we have to work with, so we do the best we can. The age range of my clients that I saw last year were basically from ages 4 to 16 years of age. All of these children had BMIs that were greater than the 97th percentile for their age. Their BMI ranged were 24 to 46. These children were all considered to be off the chart. And I can tell you that 95% of them would have been classified, if they had been an adult, as morbidly obese. So you can begin to understand the degree of difficulty in trying to attain a healthy weight for these children. It's quite extreme, very, very difficult. And when you're provided 7 hours of time to begin that process, it's even more difficult. But we hope with increased awareness in the community, increased advocacy among leaders, that things will begin to change. Thank you.
I have a question for you, please. How many children did you treat, and what was your source of referral for these children?
My source of referral for these children are through pediatricians in the community, private providers that have these children have no other resource in-house with their physician group. For instance, I don't see children who receive medical care through CHCCC because they have their own in-house dietitians. So these are children who have basically nowhere else they can go because they receive Medi-Cal. Most, if not any, dietitians in the community and private practice are Medi-Cal providers, so they can't go to somebody else for those services. And your second part of your question was, how many children did I see? Basically, in the last year, I've had on and off my roles probably in the neighborhood of 15 children. What's important to understand is, because of the dynamics of being overweight, it's a very involved process.
many of the families that come into me are not ready to begin embracing their problem. And it is a family problem. It's not an individual problem. It's a society problem. So it's often difficult to keep them coming back because they're just not at a point yet. It's like trying to go on a diet because somebody told you to, and you're not ready to do it yet.
Given that scenario, which was my concern, the relatively few number of children seen, is there anything that anybody is looking at in terms of a group type environment where perhaps more children could be treated with the amount of time allotted?
I think it would be a fabulous idea. Typically, group environments require multidisciplinary teams, including physicians, behavior therapists, dietitians, exercise physiologists. They're very expensive. They do exist, but they're very, very expensive. Out-of-pocket costs are high. Typically, these kinds of services are not covered by insurances. They're certainly not going to be covered by, you know, a public assistance insurance like Medi-Cal. But they are out there. But again, the success rate is marginal.
It'll be interesting to ask what some of the coverage is under some of the county organized health system, Medi-Cal managed care programs, because those kids are going to be in the system as children and even perhaps adults for a very long time. And that's an area where it may actually be seen as cost effective to have a multidisciplinary program like that. Yes.
I'm very concerned about physical education programs.
We're coming to schools right now, so
okay.
maybe that's
the other one is also television advertising.
Absolutely, no question about it.
How do you handle that? I mean, how are we going to be able to counteract the continuous obesity?
Maybe Governor Schwarzenegger has enough pull with industry to limit some of the, that's part of the idea behind the governor's obesity summit, but it's a very easy, simple solution for individual families. Just turn off the television. So next is Julie Andrew Scott is going to speak about EOC, Emergency Operations Center. That's what EOC also stands for, the Economic Opportunity Commission. Some of the areas they're working on in the Head Start and Child Care Resource Center.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. So here we go.
There's the mm-hmm. forward.
Thank you. Okay. Everything organized here. All right, thank you. So there are two components to our Child Care Food Co-program. We have a home-based and a center-based version. And EOC of San Luis Obispo County actually encompasses 9 different counties in California. And the food program for the centers are in those 9 counties. There's 45 of them. And then in San Luis Obispo, we have about 13, 15. And we have 130 home daycares. So we're encompassing a large population of the children that are receiving preschool education or daycare. Okay, so we're focusing tonight on what the child care program encompasses. And some statistics on childhood obesity affirm our continued sponsorship of the food program. They ensure that the children receive healthy and nutritious meals. We follow the USDA guidelines. And for the home child cares, their parents are working and the children spend more than 40 hours of week in child care. And the meal records that they've collected in the homes have indicated that the children are eating as many as 6 meals at the child care center, at the home-based child cares. So beginning their day with a balanced breakfast and enjoying a healthy meal and a snack during the middle and a nice nap and lunch is a good thing in the child care setting. Okay, I need to follow the script here. Okay. The home-based population served is in the month of July, 38,000 healthy and nutritious meals were provided in 130 different child care homes in our county. And so we believe that it's crucial that child care programs be given the resources and support to provide balanced, nutritious meals to the children in their care. And because serving healthy meals is not enough, we are working to increase the levels of physical activity and implement nutrition curriculum to encourage providers to develop healthy habits in our community's youngest children. So, in the center-based population, which I'm the food systems manager, I serve 45 centers in 9 counties daily, breakfast, lunch, and snack, and we also encompass the homeless, the shelter meals as well. But for our children, we serve about 1,500 children and about 350 adults a day, and for the month of July, we were reimbursed for 60,000 meals. Now, the percentage of our children, speaking of San Luis Obispo County, that we collected last year, actually, yeah, this year, last school year, out of our 325 Head Start children in San Luis Obispo County, we found that 27% of them were over the 95th percentile for their height and weight. And for our migrant state Head Start children, which encompasses those 9 counties, we found that out of 915 children, 23% were above the 95th percentile. So we also serve meals to the state development programs as well, and we're in the process of collecting data for them as we assess their nutritional needs. So I was asked to talk about our garden program, which I'm really proud. We had a federal review. Actually, we've had 2 federal reviews this year. It's been very exciting. And since I've been on in the Nutrition Services Division of EOC, I've worked on integrating some exercise, nutrition, and gardening components into the curriculums. And we received actually a Star of Excellence from the Federal Review Team, and they highlighted these points here, that we went above and beyond the national standards in providing nutrition education and services to the children. And some of the things that they appreciated were the nutritional services were delivered using a systematic and holistic approach, and it supported the efforts of the program to educate and involve staff and parents in the importance of nutrition in the total cognitive, physical, and socio-emotional growth and development of the enrolled children. So we also work on their parent meeting topics, and we've engaged parents for participating at home, supporting the healthy habits and physical activities necessary to foster well-being of their children. Okay, and at that time, 21 of our 23 centers in the migrant program had gardens that maximized the nutritional experiences for the children. And all of our Head Start sites in San Luis Obispo County do have gardens, so that's another 15. So let me just show you how it brightens up the schoolyard. Some of them don't have a place to grow gardens, so we buy some wine barrels and do some biodiversified crops. And that last slide was in San Luis Obispo, and this one's in Morro Bay. And you can see how it adds to their exposure in the playground. And then out of those gardens come wonderful garden fresh produce to share and do taste tests. And how we integrate it into the system is that we provide in-service to the center supervisors and staff on nutrition education, gardening, curriculum, and exercise activities for the year. We provide activities for them for their curriculum. And then we integrate a nutrition education activity during the classroom day during snack time. And let's see. So another component I was asked to share about is something new with EOC. Not new to me. I'm really into planting seeds of prevention. I love to be in the garden, and I really do love to be promoting wellness, especially in the work site. So the management team approved this nutrition and fitness policy for EOC. and we are committed to improving the health and well-being of our employees. We have to practice what we teach. So, therefore, at our workplace, we encourage healthy eating and physical activity. And encouraging healthy eating, we have healthy food options available at meetings, and we have options in the vending machine. And we provide educational resources, classes, encouraging healthy eating within and outside the workplace. We have a little wellness center set up in our organization now. And we also encourage physical activity by encouraging our employees to utilize breaks as a time to walk or stretch to get out of the box, and incorporating exercise breaks into meetings, promoting the use of stairs, walking paths, and fitness facilities if they're available, and educational resources, classes, promoting it. So we do say, before starting a diet or exercise program, to consult their physician. So it's a voluntary donation-based program right now. And this is what we will be doing. We are going to orientate the employees in our main office. Other sites are invited, but it's time. I don't know if a lot of them will have time to travel here. So we're setting up wellness kits for each of our main offices. And we're hoping to get some funding to have wellness centers in each of our centers, the child care centers. So in October, we're going to have an orientation. We're going to meet the first Friday of the month. And from 12 to 12:15, we're going to have a little food demo in the kitchen. And then we'll go into the boardroom and have a presentation. And then we'll go outside and stretch and walk. So and these subjects here were based on a wellness staff survey. And that concludes my portion. So come and join us. It's the first Friday of the month at the EOC main office boardroom if you want to check it out.
Thank you, Julie. Our next speaker is our two speakers, Judy Stevens and Mary. Oh, two or three speakers? Three speakers. I'm going to sit over there then. Yes, sure. Judy Stevens and Mary Oates, and the third person is Linda. Okay, Linda Hogemoon is a school health nurse that we've worked a lot with over in public health.
We didn't practice this part. So. We weren't sure what the format was going to be. I'm Judy Stevens, and I'm a registered dietitian. I'm the director of food services at LCMR School District, which is the largest school district in the county. We have 11,000 students. And so we have kind of a complex part of this whole thing, feeding the kids. As many of you may know, the National School Lunch Program was created after World War II, when we had kind of the opposite problem that we have now. We had a lot of malnourished, underweight children. So they created the program to make sure that kids were fed, and we grew a population of healthier kids. And now 60 years later, we have kind of the opposite problem. So it's that's kind of an interesting twist, and a lot of it has to do with our lifestyles, which we've all talked about tonight. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you what challenges the school districts are up against with feeding kids. Our lunch program is actually breakfast and lunch program are mandated by the USDA. All school districts have to have them, and the standards are monitored by the state of California. Lucia, we have several different options that we can go by, and Lucia Mar is following a nutrient standards menu plan, and also what we call a SHAPE option. And basically, nutrient standards means that we have to analyze the menus to meet certain criteria. And the meals are based on a third of the recommended dietary allowances of certain targets of calories, protein, iron, vitamin A, vitamin C. And if you notice under the calorie requirements, they might seem a little shocking. They seem kind of high. But that is based on what students of those age groups are supposed to have as a third of their recommended calorie allotments. And it needs to be less than 30% fat and less than 10% saturated fat. The SHAPE option is a California option that allows us to have some flexibility in what the children choose. And we offer entrees and side dishes and milk, and they can pick and choose what they want. We encourage them to take a balance, but they only have to take two options. And where this really helps is for individual preferences. It also helps for varying appetites and calorie needs. So in the case of obesity, that's really a good thing. So we don't have to give them all the components that come up to those calorie levels, because not all of the children really need those calorie levels, but they are provided. This next slide shows the choices that we have in Lucia Mar. Most of the school districts in this area, this county, are pretty much following the same kind of a pattern. Is that we'll have at the elementary school a daily entree special, like we will have a sandwich or baked chicken nuggets or a hamburger or pizza, kind of kid-friendly entrees. And then we have at all of our elementary schools and high schools, we have a full salad bar. So in addition to the entree choices, they can choose from various salads and vegetables and fruits. And then we also offer milk. So we have the 1% white milk and non-fat chocolate milk. And earlier somebody was talking about the fact that children don't drink enough milk, don't get enough calcium. And an argument you often hear is that we shouldn't give them chocolate milk. But it's really better for them to have chocolate milk to get the calcium and protein that they need than to not drink milk at all. And that's kind of a family teaching. You know, a lot of families don't drink regular milk. So I feel really strongly that that's a good thing. And our middle schools and high schools, we have more choices. We have 4 to 6 entrees a day, and then they also have a salad, carrot sticks, fresh fruit, juice, and milk that they can choose from. And the high schools, because of the facilities that we have there, have a really nice full salad bar that they can choose from. One thing I didn't touch on because of time, I kind of left it out, but with the breakfast program, earlier somebody mentioned the fact that children need to jumpstart their day with breakfast. And we do serve a breakfast program also, but one of the biggest problems that schools face is the timing on breakfast, because school starts at an early hour, and either families dropping kids off, kids walking, or the buses create a real problem with them getting there in time to be able to eat. And one of the things some school districts have done is allowed children to eat in the classroom. And it's been really successful, because then during the time when they're taking enrollment and various other morning activities, they can eat breakfast. And so that's how some of the school districts have solved it. But it does add other issues that are problems in the school district. So we do try to feed them breakfast, but it doesn't always work. And one of my main concerns to try to improve school foods is to try to increase the use of fruits, vegetables, and dairy products. I think if we can do that, and in this population of people that eat a lot of fast foods, if they can have that as a basis, I think that's really important. So that's why our emphasis on the salad bars. And also another goal is to try to find acceptable alternatives for high fat and high sugar products for a la carte sales. We're going to get to a la carte sales in a minute and tell you why we have them. Also, a good thing that's happened at the school campuses this year, I think countywide, is that there are no sodas allowed. Previously, we've never had them in elementary schools, and previously they were allowed at the middle schools, and we phased those out last year. And this year, we have other beverages, but not sodas. You know, so I think a lot of people are happy about that. I don't know how many of you are familiar with school budgets, but something people are often surprised to find, and I was surprised to find when I started to work with the school district, is that school district food service programs are self-funded. We get no general fund money. It's whatever we make is how we what we have to spend, and we have, in my particular district, I have a $3.7 million budget and 70 employees, and so all of those expenses come out of the budget on what we have earned in reimbursable meals and also in a la carte sales. And in this county, you saw some statistics earlier on the percentages of free and reduced meals at the schools in the county. Those were a little bit lower than what my experience has been. It varies throughout the year depending on some of the migrant students and just the application process of applying for free and reduced meals. But our district, we have about 40% free and reduced, which is kind of in the middle. It's not real bad, but it's not real good. And what that means is that only 40% of the children in our district can eat free or reduced meals. And in our district and also throughout the county, the reduced meal prices, we waive the cost. So anyone that qualifies for free or reduced meals, we give them free meals. And then, of course, students can buy them, too, at a fairly reasonable cost. So we have, that is a real challenge to the budget, because that's probably only represents about half of my budget. And so in my district and also the rest of the San Luis County, we depend on a la carte sales. And you have to sell kids things that they want. And the way families are with their eating preferences, this is why sometimes there's controversial foods that are being sold. And we're all trying to find better alternatives, but it has to come from student preferences also on that to be able to do that. So it's kind of complex. So it's really a challenge to be able to meet all the regulations that we have to meet, to be able to get student preferences in there, so not only with the reimbursable meals, but also with the a la carte items, that we can get things that are healthier and that they will eat, and that we can keep them on campus, too, because one of our campuses, our Rio Grande campus, is an open campus, and a lot of students leave. So trying to keep them on there. So it gets kind of complicated. And one thing that all school districts are also doing by this July, by July 1st, we have to have this implemented, is the USDA has mandated as part of the Child Nutrition Program that all school districts have a wellness policy. And this wellness policy is not just for what we serve, but it's kind of just the attitudes throughout the whole campuses. It's the emphasis on better nutrition and on physical fitness in all aspects, whether it be in the classroom, whether it be in activities, and in our program. And these goals are up there. There are some requirements of what they must contain. They have to have education, nutrition education, and physical activity, and other school-based activities. So, for instance, it's kind of trying to promote children doing more walking during recess or physical education and in different activities that they have on campus. Sometimes it'll get into classroom parties and that sort of thing, that they're trying to get healthier items served in it. So it's kind of a whole district-wide approach. And we have to also make sure that the guidelines for reimbursable meals aren't any more restrictive than what the, I mean, less restrictive than what the government requires, which we aren't. We also have to go through a compliance review, and we did that last year and came out very well. So we are following those guidelines. And then they also have to dictate somebody that's going to monitor this. So we haven't quite done that yet as far as figuring that. But we're pretty far ahead in our process in LUCMR. The policy dictates who should be on the committee, and it includes parents, students, food service people, school administrators, board members, students, and members of the public. And we've already started that process and have most of those people on our committee. We're still looking for some more people to fit all the needs of both the requirements and also what will help us really implement the program. And the emphasis in our district, we have a really positive committee, and it's rather than talking about all the bad things that people do, we're trying to emphasize the positive. We're trying to emphasize, you know, let's try and eat more fruits and vegetables and dairy and have a healthy base of the diet and do more physical activity rather than, you know, don't eat this and don't eat that. So it's been a real positive group. So this is leading into our wellness policy. But, of course, the biggest challenge with these policies also is to try to be able to do what we need to do with nutrition in the classroom and increasing physical fitness without the funding that the government is, you know, not really providing for that. So that is a real challenge for all school districts. It's not that people don't want to do it for the most part. It's that there's no money or no time with all the other requirements that they have. And also one of my goals is to not only implement that but keep my budget in the black. One other thing that I wanted to point out that we've been talking about Cal Poly and the kinesiology department helping with some other things. We are also going to be implementing them to try to help us in our department come up with an attitude awareness of, in the high school level, because one of the biggest challenges that we face in getting kids to want what we should be feeding them is to find out what their attitudes are about it, what their attitudes about obesity and nutrition and fitness are, and what they would think would be something that they would accept as far as food on the campus. So they're going to help us with that this fall. So that's a real positive thing. I'm really looking forward to that. And this cartoon kind of adds a little bit of a humor to the seriousness of this, but it also points out, if you can't read it, it says, "Ah, it's nice to be home. The only food they serve at school these days is good for you." And what that kind of points out is the fact that it is a society problem. You know, we're trying to make improvements, but it's very difficult when families have the kind of behavior like going out to fast food all the time, not cooking at home, not doing the physical activity. So it really does. And this next one, we were talking about marketing also and how marketing on TV is really bad. Well, this is something we discovered actually accidentally. We've been buying these carrots for quite some time. It's little bagged baby carrots that we serve at school. And we noticed them flying out of the elementary school salad bars this year. And then we looked a little closer and noticed that they have a SpongeBob character on that. So I thought this was a really great example of a positive marketing, and maybe that's what we need to do in television is get, you know, it's like the five a day. If you notice sometimes on the ready-made fruits and vegetables, in the vegetable packages you buy now, there's a lot of emphasis on this five a day and, you know, eat the colorway and everything like that, and that really appeals to kids. So that's something I thought was kind of fun. In your packet, there's some more slides that of children in our salad bars, but we were unable to get the parental releases to show them. So I'm showing the slides, but it shows some of the pictures of our salad bars, and I have some in color if anybody wants to look at them. So I'm going to turn this over to Linda Hogeboom, who is our school nurse, and she's going to continue on with some of our things we're doing.
Judy, before you depart, I have one question on your reimbursement.
Mm-hmm.
Is that reimbursement based upon actual meals purchased, the free?
Yes.
And not just number of children that
Correct.
Are eligible?
We have the eligibility, which allows that many children to eat for free, but it's only the daily participation that we get reimbursed for. So we have actually a computer program that tracks all that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage of the students eat on campus or bring their lunches? And then the other one is approximately what does it cost for a breakfast and
okay.
for a lunch?
The costs of our breakfast, it's a dollar campus district-wide, regardless of the age level. And at lunch, it's $1.75 at the elementary and middle school, and it's $2 at the high school. And that's for all of the items that I talked about with the salad bar and the entree. And the other thing was you want to know how many students we're feeding. We're feeding, I actually just looked that up today because I thought somebody might ask. So far, right now, at the beginning of the year, we're serving about 1,600 breakfasts, which out of 11,000 students isn't very many. It's only about 14%. And 4,300 lunches, which is about 30%. The good thing is with the kids that are eligible, those numbers are about double that. We're serving about 30% of the eligible students and about 60% of at breakfast and about 60% at lunchtime. So, you know, we're doing a good job there.
Good evening. Developing and implementing a new mandate is never easy. We're fortunate to have great support of our teachers, administrators, and school board members. And the committee that Judy talked about has been tremendously supportive in terms of jump-starting the whole effort. The good news also is that we're not starting from scratch. I feel like our district has always valued health and wellness, and we have a solid foundation in all of the key components that are required of this policy. So I'm going to just give you a brief overview of our nutrition education. 10 years ago, our district adopted a K-12 health framework, which includes nutrition standards, and it was developed by a committee of teachers, and it is closely aligned with the state and national standards. At the K-3 level, it's a real integrated approach. The teachers teach concepts of health and wellness in their daily discussions and interactions with their students. Many teachers do utilize the Dairy Council program that provides excellent age-appropriate lesson plans. The importance of healthy eating is demonstrated in class through the creation of junk food-free zones. Parents are provided a list of healthy snack options that they can use when they are donating or providing their children with snacks to have between meals. In our fourth, fifth, and sixth grades, we actually have itinerant health science teachers that come into the classroom and teach a weekly lesson that is either health-based or science-based. And this does include quite a bit of nutrition education. In the secondary grades, there are nutritional courses that are science-based that are elective classes, which means that not all the students take the courses, but this is a great improvement over the last few years. For quite a few years, there really wasn't a great amount of information being discussed at the junior high, middle school level. So I'm real happy to see that more and more is available. At ninth grade, there is a required health class, and they do have about a two-week component in that's devoted specifically to nutrition. For physical fitness, at the elementary levels, this is an area that I'm sure the PE teachers would like to see improved, and yet again, it's very difficult when we have the time constraints and the financial constraints that we do have. At this time, there are 2 days a week where a credentialed physical education teacher works with our elementary students, so it's 100 minutes a week that they're provided. The classroom teachers augment this with activities in the classroom that focus on movement. Some schools have actually used fundraising efforts that promote physical activity. An example of this is the American Heart Association's Jump Rope for Heart. At the secondary level, PE is a daily requirement in the 7th through 10th grades, and students in the 11th and 12th grade can take PE as an elective. In addition to PE classes, our two high schools have approximately 20 sports, individual and team sports, that students can choose to participate in. It is estimated that approximately 25 to 35% of the student populations at our high schools participate in one or more sports. At six of our elementary schools, we have an after-school enrichment program entitled Bright Futures. It is funded through a federally funded 21st Century grant, and daily attendance averages around 600 children. And of those 600 children, approximately 60% of them participate in a one-hour physical fitness activity each day. Our wellness committee highlights. I'm really excited about this committee. It's just fun to see the energy that is being brought to the table. And you'll meet the energy person in a minute here. Our wellness committee met for the first time in February of last year, and in 6 months we achieved our two objectives. The first objective was to write a grant that would help us access resources. And the first grant that we wrote was this July to the Gold Coast Collaborative. And they are currently providing small grants that target policy development, which focuses on the reduction of childhood obesity. And in July, we wrote the grant, and with the hope that it would help assist us in our wellness policy development. Our grant was given a favorable review, and we are hopeful that with a few minor changes that they have requested that we make, we will be able to see some funding come fall or winter winter months. We also applied in partnership with our South County Youth Coalition for a charitable contribution from Tenet Healthcare Foundation. We requested funds that would provide pedometers for our fourth grade students. I've been in contact with their spokesperson from Sierra Vista Hospital, and again, they are interested in our proposal, but the decision to fund it is still pending. Our second objective in our wellness committee was to develop ideas which would promote wellness in the classrooms, would be easy for schools to implement, and fun for the kids. It was really important to keep it simple. to come to a classroom teacher and tell her that we have a great idea and it will only take 50 hours of her time or his time to implement is not going to go too far. So we needed to keep it simple. So at Napomo Elementary, we had a volunteer who is a Healthy Start coordinator in our district, and what she decided to do is she took 15 pedometers that we had been given from the Gold Coast Collaborative and showed up every Monday at lunchtime. And just told the kids, anyone who wants to come out and walk with me, show up. And each Monday, they have three lunch periods. It's a very large school. And each lunch period, she would get on average 25 children coming to walk with her. She didn't have enough pedometers for everyone, so it's, they had a wait list, and they would walk for about 25 or 30 minutes. At the end of the year, they said that they really loved it, that they loved the social interactions that they had, and just and obviously the pedometers were a big hit. At Shell Beach Elementary School, we ran a pilot program in May, and 56 students in the third grade received a pedometer for a week and were asked to track their steps and activity. In a post-survey, 100% of the students said the pedometers helped increase their exercise routine. The average daily steps recorded per student were 4,000 to 5,000 steps, which is approximately 2.5 miles. The entire student population and their parents received a weekly article in their school newsletter and were invited to participate in a turn-off screen day. 30% of the families participated, and of the ones who returned their surveys, 100% said they wanted to see more of this next year. And with that, I just want to introduce one of our committee members and a parent in our district, Dr. Mary Oates.
Good evening. As you just saw, we're working through available channels to improve nutrition and healthy physical activity at the school level. However, our efforts will be incomplete without a cooperative effort between school districts, the county, healthcare providers, hospitals, large employers, agricultural partners, faith-based organizations, and community groups to educate the adult family members about nutrition and healthy physical activity. Personally, I envision a centralized cooperative sharing of resources such as dietitians, nutritionists, school curriculum, lecture halls, sports and physical activity schedules, and healthful cooking classes. My main medical practice is in Santa Maria, and recently the city of Santa Maria has committed to facilitate and fund the infrastructure of a newly organized Santa Maria Valley Health and Nutrition Group, and I hope that we can see something similar here.
Thank you. And then to finish the presentation, I need to ask the chair how you all are doing. As that you've been sitting for, let's see, almost 2 hours.
2 hours.
Do you want a five-minute break, or do you want to push through and complete?
It was my thought to do that after the presentation was over, but if it would be of interest to the rest of the group, we could do it now.
I don't want anybody to have any.
Keep going. All right. We'd like to go ahead and hear the rest
okay.
of the presentation.
Given that the camera is focusing on us and Yuki is coming up here, and it's, I want to tell you it's very strange to have this robot less than 3 feet away adjusting itself as you move your fingers. But since the camera is over here, you might want to stand up and stretch because I don't think anybody can concentrate when they're numb from sitting too long. So our next speaker is Yuki. And I'm sorry, Nishinaga, I'm sorry. And this To advance the PowerPoint, it's the down arrow. And Yushi is involved in creative nutrition concepts, and I'll let her take it away.
Well, thank you for having us, first off. But before I get started, I'm going to let Dr. Lisa Nicholson and Carla Quiroga, my partner with Creative Nutrition Concepts, pass out a gift for you. It's a five-a-day lunch bag, and it's reusable and healthy and fun. It'll remind you to eat five fruits and vegetables a day, which is very important. Well, once again, I really want to thank you, one, for taking this time to listen to us and to hear the things we have to say. My name is Yuki Nishinaga, and I'm one of the co-directors of a local organization called Creative Nutrition Concepts. You just met Carla Quiroga, also one of the co-founders, as well as Linda Olds, who you may or may not know as one of the local co-founders of Jamba Juice, as well as one of our integral program managers in helping us with our program management, which is great. Creative Nutrition Concepts is a 501c3 nonprofit organization focused on community-based nutrition education. So what we pride ourselves on is empowerment through education. And what that means is that every program and services that CNC provides is focused on empowering individuals, teachers, parents, school districts, and policymakers to take a very active stand on educating themselves and others in the community to provide more health and nutrition to their people. How we're able to do this is by setting up programs and services needed by the community through a business model that we use actively called our Campus Community Partnership. On this next slide, you'll see this is basically what we do for all of our major programs. And there's four major components. There's our local businesses, local universities, children, and CNC in the middle. The reason why all four of these play such an important role is that local businesses provide us great opportunities for fundraising, for PR, for exposing what we're doing out in the community. They also donate products, equipment, food, everything we need to make things happen. The local universities as well play a huge, huge role because they also provide the most amazing and energetic college-level interns from the kinesiology departments, nutrition, modern languages, and several others to go out in the community and teach nutrition and fitness education. So in that way, they're not only getting an amazing opportunity in the community, but they're also getting great work experience, which is really important for everyone. As well as working with local universities, we are able to have the most current, up-to-date information, as well as have opportunities to consult with PhD-level professors like Lisa Nicholson, who came up, so that we're making sure that all of our information is the most credible and up-to-date things that we can provide our local kids. The third aspect is our children, and this, I kind of left children in general, because we mainly go to schools, but we also go to after-school programs, local organizations like the YMCA, community events, and festivals. And basically, wherever kids are, CNC really loves to be at. So it's wherever they're at, we want to go to. And in the middle, we have CNC. And basically, what we do is we play the middleman. We're able to facilitate, coordinate, and manage all these programs and services that we're able to do. And in turn, we're able to create sustainable working models, something with a strong foundation that we know that we can count on, that the community's supporting, the schools are supporting, and in turn, the kids get something really great for them. The mission behind this, too, and all this comes together, is to focus on combating childhood obesity, which is why we're here today to talk to you. Some of the programs and services that we do provide children nutrition education programs, which we have two programs currently with San Luis Coastal called the Jamba Juice Healthy Kids Program and the Healthy Beats Program. Both of them are focused on nutrition and fitness, and currently we're able to provide 550 kids every year in the fourth grade level with nutrition and fitness education. were able to provide four consecutive lessons at, I'm sorry, there's actually 9 elementary schools, not 18, but 18 classrooms. That's an edit. With that, we're able to provide pre- and post-assessment tests to kind of measure the knowledge increase or decrease with these kids. And what we found over the past 2 years in doing this is that we found an increase of 50% of their knowledge base, which is a really wonderful result from them. So if a kid really didn't know anything about these basic nutrition concepts, they would gain a great understanding at least of what they're learning. As well as the children benefiting from it, there are over 20 college-level students every year that actually are able to go out in the community, manage their own classes, teach nutrition and fitness, and get great work experience every year. We work really closely with university administration, San Luis Coastal admin people, and businesses, all add a really key and integral component of CNC programs. The other types of programs that we provide are Hispanic nutrition education. Currently, we are working with 150 parents at local EOC centers by teaching them cooking classes, by providing them with nutrition and health information. And one of the most amazing aspects of this is that it gives them an opportunity to come together, to network, to ask questions. And it's wonderful for them to not only receive these great services in the classroom, but to have an opportunity to instill these same values at home. So that's what we do. We provide them with these opportunities to kind of come together. We are currently working closely with EOC as well as Cal Poly to design sustainable educational resources so that in the future they'll have ongoing resources of nutrition and fitness so they could provide the parents and site supervisors. And the last one is our healthy community events, which basically CNC becomes kind of like event coordinators for healthy, positive family events, such as the Healthy Kids Energy Zone. We created this year to kind of give kids an opportunity to do something fun at a local event, like a triathlon or a fun run, things like that. There's several stations that we set up that have fun nutrition activities, fitness activities, space painting, anything fun and healthy to get the kids excited, we're there and doing it. This year, since May, we are able to set up 4 events. As small as 700 people to over 45,000 people attending these events actually got to see the Healthy Kids Energy Zone. As well as we teamed up with Jamba Juice, local and corporate, to do the Jamba Juice Banana Man Chase, which is basically a fun run for kids and parents to do races, chase bananas, and, you know, just have fun. And the Healthy Kids Energy Zone was there. It's a fantastic, fantastic area for local businesses, healthy businesses, you know, parents and kids all come together, as well it's a fundraiser for CNC programs, which we're really proud of. You know, in conclusion, what we really try to do is really strive to empower people like you, parents, teachers, and everyone to get more involved with setting policies and nutrition standards that are really positive for the community. We're currently working on towards replicating our campus community partnership models in new communities by reaching new funding sources, finding new community partners, and getting great support from the local one existing, as well as develop products and services to reach new populations with more fun, interactive, and positive nutrition education. So we just want to thank you so much for having us today, and let us know if you have any questions. And that's it.
Thank you very much. Let's move to the next step. So the next slide is what would be potential next steps. One person who did not speak tonight because of short notice and because we actually figured we had packed this as tight as we could and we went over, I apologize, was Chuck Stevenson from the Planning Department. And I, if you will remember back couple of months ago, we presented information on the Board of Supervisors voting to adopt the Smart Growth Guidelines. Those Smart Growth Guidelines, among others in regards to planning our communities, talk about things that can be done to encourage physical activity. such as, you know, last time I went walking in my neighborhood, I was walking in the middle of the street because there's no sidewalks. So when you plan a community, you put in sidewalks. Commercial areas, putting supermarkets so far away or markets so far away you have no choice but to drive means you're going to drive. So that mixed-use areas, residential areas, and commercial areas, planning the cul-de-sac design means that to go from point A to point B, sometimes you have to drive about 8 blocks to go around the block to get to neighbor Johnny's house. And I love the slide of the Caratini. Did you see the Caratini? A Caratini is better than a martini. I want you to remember that. I want to just say that planning is extremely interested in the smart growth area, particularly in the area of encouraging physical activity. And you get people outside, you create a sense of community. You get enough people outside with a sense of community, you create a safer community. You get more people coming outside because they're not afraid to come out, and you get a blossoming community, something that I think we all want. Okay, so what are the recommendations? Well, the Gold Coast Collaborative, last meeting we talked about what could we ask the Health Commission to do. And number one, we believe that it would be helpful for the Health Commission to request the Board of Supervisors appoint a multidisciplinary obesity epidemic response task force, that truly a multidisciplinary bringing together education people. You see how important education is because that's where kids spend so much time of their day. Government leaders in regards to planning, some industry leaders, people who can get farm fresh products into institutions, and the list goes on. That secondly, a staff position be funded to assist countywide implementation of obesity prevention and response. Third, that the county establish a active wellness program for all county employees. You've got almost 4,000 county employees, and in many other counties there are county wellness programs that not only have programs that get employees out walking, encouraging walking and other exercise during breaks and lunch, improve nutrition. They can work on some of the snack breaks that employees have and get the doctors to stop bringing donuts to the nurses and various other things like that. They also work, wellness programs work on issues like mental health issues and avoiding back injuries, not only through healthy lifting but being in better shape. That the county, that the Health Commission co-sponsor an obesity summit that the Gold Coast Collaborative has been working towards probably in late spring of 2006, which hopefully would include an interim report of a task force that might have been established. That the Health Commission encouraged the Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors to use smart growth principles, especially those encouraging physical activity in their planning decisions. And encourage public health staff to use budgetary process and grant opportunities to confront the obesity epidemic on all appropriate fronts. So that's food for thought for the commission, my apologies for going past 7:45, but we got a late start.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Are there any other questions from the commissioners of Dr. Thomas regarding these recommendations? Commissioner Hetherington?
I guess in looking at the recommendations, and thank you all, one and all, this was probably one of the most comprehensive educational opportunities this commission has had in a long, long time. And I think you've covered everything quite readily. But in looking at the next steps and, you know, seeing the expertise in this room, Greg, where are you going with this multidisciplinary task force when you've got this wealth of people here? Are you thinking of pulling them to another entity?
Sure.
What are you visualizing?
As a Gold Coast Collaborative, and maybe Lisa Nicholson could come up and speak a little bit about this, because she's been a leader in the Gold Coast Collaborative, and we've talked about where we would go with a something like this. The Gold Coast Collaborative really includes health people. And this is more than health people. This is, as we've talked about, health and education people. We need a wider group, and we need the ability to pull in decision makers on a county level.
The Gold Coast Health Collaborative started with the three counties, Santa Barbara, Ventura, and San Luis Obispo. And at that point, it was a lot of concerned individuals. We did have help organizing from the state, also the USDA and the Cancer Nutrition and Prevention Services. From that point, each of the counties has been working, and the problem with in one sense, and also the benefit of the collaborative, is it is very concerned with the environmental model. It takes a village. It takes a lot of people to create change in a community. No one person. It's not the schools. It's not the parents. But it is the schools, and it is the parents. So the idea then is the next step would need to be action, and action takes place within a community. Within that community, then, we're organizing around those. But the Gold Coast Health Collaborative is an organizing umbrella. It's not an action force. They do have some funds. Again, we have some state funds from Department of Health and Human Services, USDA. But they can only make these grants. These grants need to be used, then, at the community level. So within each community, we need to have organizing bodies that can ask for these grants, that can implement policies, that can make the kind of changes, even to get a sidewalk in a community. Think how hard that is. And yet, if we want kids to walk to school, that would take everybody on this board and everybody in this room and every concerned parent to get that to happen. So the idea of the Gold Coast Collaborative is that it should be a catalyst within communities, but communities need to take the actions on their own.
Thank you. That was question number one. I would suggest, I'm definitely in favor of the recommendations, don't get me wrong, but I think, you know, as we watch funds diminish rather than increase, I would hate to reinvent the wheel. And I would hate to ask each one of those knowledgeable people to say, okay, come over to another task force, another set of meetings. You know, and I guess I want to be assured that when we think of results, as that one lady explained, that she was reaching out to maybe 15 students, that, you know, is this thing going to be more powerful than that? Is it going to reach more people than that? I mean, when we ask the board to dedicate funds, you know, I always remember David Edge's horrific face, you know, what do you mean more money for this? You know? So I want to make sure that we look at this in a context that it's doable, that it's going to achieve the goals and objectives that you set forth. And I would recommend also that with this collaborative that maybe we can work it into our public health week activities in some way, shape, or form. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Commissioner Warren, you were pulling your mic.
Yes. Well, I do have a question, and if this is going to have a task force, do we really know if we need an employee at this time to do that? You know, there's a lot of task forces that if you're looking for action and you've got a lot of groups here that, you know, can't that be divided up within that group and maybe make that decision later?
As we envisioned this, the employee was not a task force employee. It was, there really is no position, there is no direct funding for, except for in maternal and child health, mm-hmm. working on the weight of 3 to 5 year olds, there really is no direct funding for working on obesity per se. Well, the funding for chronic diseases in the county and the state is pretty abysmal. It's not seen as has not been a priority to fund because infectious disease has really been the cornerstone. You know, the idea that there needs to be funding for somebody to coordinate anti-obesity actions, whether it be from the task force or whether it be just what we need to do, what we know we need to have to do. You need person power to do that. And Beth has been good enough to, I think we identified $5,000 that we could spend, and that paid for a limited period of time for Beth to work, but that's not going to go forever.
Okay, and I have a second question, which kind of leads into that, is has anybody in this group been working with the statistics from the Kaiser Permanente study, the ACE study, the adverse childhood experiences that Dr. Vincent Folletti has done, and how is that being incorporated into this process?
I don't believe per se that it's been addressed, looked at. So it's probably a good point.
I think that's a real primary place to for us to include that in this whole process.
Yep.
Dr. Pinkel, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to ask, what do we do next? What's the next step?
Well,
for us.
Oh, for us as a commission, I think the next step might be to entertain a motion to accept these recommendations. Would anybody like to make a motion?
I so move.
Okay.
Accept these recommendations.
Okay. Shall we be a little more specific? That we write a letter to the Board of Supervisors supporting these recommendations.
Yes.
Okay. There's a motion on the floor. Is there a second to the motion?
I'm hearing a little bit of hesitancy.
I need a second to the motion. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead. Okay, discussion. Sorry for that point of order. A little out of place. I'm hearing a bit of hesitancy in terms of supporting the recommendation for the staff person, as well as maybe not as much in terms of another task force. I wanted to know if any of the other commissioners wanted to discuss that more, if we were in agreement to support that recommendation as it is written to go to the Board of Supervisors with modifications.
Commissioner Heatherington.
My concern with the task force is that, you know, you've got a group of people that's probably already overtaxed. Now, are you visualizing those bodies going into a new task force? And my concern is are you going to dilute any of the efforts that these people are striving to achieve by saying, okay, well, we're starting a new game over here? And I definitely see that, having been on task force before, that, you know, you can pull away from the great work that they're doing by creating another wheel over here. And that's the one thing that I really would like to not see happen. So who are you envisioning to be on this task force, Dr. Thomas?
I would envision certainly some of the members of the Gold Coast Collaborative. I would envision the Board of Supervisors actually nominating and naming some people, perhaps from local government, from school districts, from other parts of county government, planning, and parent-teacher associations. So a wider group, getting a wider target. But certainly if you want to take this back and talk about it, discuss it over the next month, that would be okay too. So it's really up to the commission at this venture point.
I guess what I would like to see is maybe a member of the health commission on the task force, so that
absolutely,
that there is some collaboration between us and this new committee. And, you know, if a red flag comes up to a health commissioner saying, hey, you know, you're kind of pulling over here and, you know, to go over here, I would think that that would satisfy my,
I think that would be a very
curiosity.
Good idea. Yeah.
So I can support Dr. Pinkel's motion, unless somebody has a problem with staff hiring. I'm sure that will come from the board.
Okay. Is there any further discussion of the motion? Commissioner Hale.
I'd just say that, you know, as I read these things, they're very broad-based and not specifically saying who and how much and how many meetings and how, you know, I think that it's great to address some energy this direction because, you know, it's a huge problem. And if we can make some progress there, you know, that's to me more beneficial than probably anything else that we've been involved in the Health Commission since I've been on the Health Commission. So that's why I support it. I think it's a great endeavor, and I sense lots of energy out here in these folks. And, you know, I'm looking at the pictures of those salad bars, and I'm saying, gosh, you know, do you have to be in school to eat at school? Because for $2, I mean, it'd be a good place for all of us to go for lunch, you know? It's a pretty good deal. And so that's what it is. It's really a good deal. And that's why I support it.
I don't want to come off as not supporting this because I think it's wonderful. I am very encouraged by the results that you have achieved thus far and look forward to exponentially increasing those results. And if this task force can help do that, that would be fabulous. I think it's a very underserved area. We need a lot more attention in this area. So thank you again for your presentation. It was very, very well done, very well received. Thank you.
Lynn?
Commissioner Warren.
And I, too, wanted to thank everybody for your presentation and what was here. Having served on school site councils for 10 years, that was one of our biggest issues was the lack of nutrition in school lunches. And it's taken a long time for it to get here, and I really like the community approach. And I hope that we can hear more from you and really see a change in how we deal with nutrition in families and that education from that preventive standpoint.
Okay, there being no further discussion, all those in favor of the motion to write a formal letter to the Board of Supervisors supporting the six recommendations of the Gold Coast Collaborative, please say aye.
Aye.
It appears that the motion has passed unanimously. I think that this is really great. You've made a wonderful presentation and addressed a big problem. I think that everybody in the healthcare field is aware of it being just an enormous, that's kind of the right choice of words, problem. And I would like to venture further as far as the Health Commission is concerned that maybe we would have one or two, three people from the Health Commission to kind of follow these points through until the task force is established. And maybe once the task force is established, we'd have maybe a member on the commission but or on the task force. But at this time, it might be, would there be anybody that would be willing to volunteer to kind of follow this along after we send the letter? How come there's always so many volunteers?
What do you mean by follow it along?
Well, I'm thinking in terms of two or three people that would maybe meet once or twice as we'll send the letter to the Board of Supervisors. I'm not sure when they will act on it. There are a number of components to this that are kind of interesting and exciting, the county wellness program itself. And that way we could have a report back on is anything going on with these items and track it. That's the exact choice of words, yes, track it. Did I hear you volunteering? Thank you. Okay.
Yes.
Anybody else? Yep. All right. So Commissioner Hetherington, Commissioner Shimosis? That'll do. Okay. We are now in recess for a break. We'll return in 10 minutes. Yeah, we might. Welcome back to the balance of the Health Commission meeting for September.
Next on our agenda is the Managed Care Interim Report. Dr. Thomas.
Thank you. I wanted to provide an interim report. The managed care, Medi-Cal Managed Care Advisory Task Force has been meeting since April to look at the various options in regards to Medi-Cal Managed Care. We decided once the governor's managed care Medi-Cal proposal was issued in January, we decided that bringing community members and physicians together was important to, yes. Well, this is the first slide, meaningful slide, so. The other one says Medi-Cal managed care. So that looking at options, and I'll try and run through this quite quickly because it is fairly late. A recommendation is coming to the board in the on October 4th, and I'll kind of run through. It's a preliminary one. It's not a final one. These are the members of the Managed Care Advisory Task Force. Joel Derringer is in the audience, and he was one of the members of the task force, as well as the members you can see in front of you. And this is the timeline that we followed, meeting every 3 weeks, April through September. Well, there's our governor, and our governor did propose a Medi-Cal redesign. Currently, Medi-Cal managed care is in 22 counties in California, and 13 additional counties were identified. They started with the biggest, and they're moving into the medium-sized counties at this point. And we were surprised, identified as one of the 13 medium-sized counties to begin planning. And the governor put forth the goal of increasing access and improving health outcomes through managed care expansion. The statewide Medi-Cal program currently expends $34 billion. I'll repeat that, $34 billion in California. Half of that is federal money. Since 1999, the state Medi-Cal expenditures have grown by 60%. That is, they've grown, state expenditures have grown $4.5 billion. And in the same time, the Medi-Cal beneficiary numbers have increased by 32%. So the cost per beneficiary has gone up. And obviously, given the structural problem in the government or in the state's budget, this rate of expenditure is not sustainable. 50% of the Medi-Cal beneficiaries are in the fee-for-service system, and that includes San Luis Obispo County. 50% of the Medi-Cal beneficiaries are in a Medi-Cal managed care system, and that includes Santa Barbara County, our neighbor. However, fee-for-service beneficiaries account for 77% of total Medi-Cal expenditures, and managed care Medi-Cal beneficiaries account for 23%. Now, there's part of that is that the aged, blind, and disabled category of Medi-Cal in the other non-county organized health systems are not in Medi-Cal managed care. And the governor's proposal does propose to include the category of aged, blind, and disabled, mostly seniors, into Medi-Cal managed care in other counties. But seniors and persons with disabilities do account for 25% of the Medi-Cal population and 53% of the expenditure. So you can see that's where a lot of the expenditures do go. The government, as this was presented, the goals were maintain essential services, improve access, promote the use of preventive services, maximize program integration, maximize federal funds. There is a $160 million that the federal government has said, you know, if you move forward with this, we will advance an additional $160 million per year over the next couple of years, $320 million involved in a federal Medi-Cal waiver. Part of this to assist community hospitals and safety net hospitals, and particularly county hospitals that are struggling. One of the issues is CHC, and we have created a safety net in San Luis Obispo County that does use community health centers as a provider, primary provider of Medi-Cal services for primary care. And so they, under this system, would see the same level of reimbursement. They would get a capitated rate, but then the difference would be paid back at the end of the year through a budget reconciliation. In the federally qualified health centers in Monterey and Santa Cruz counties, they actually get some additional money as incentives for quality of care indicators, just like specialists and primary care doctors get. Now, one of the issues that when they say improve care, the current, I'm sorry about the small print here, these are the County Organized Health System HEDIS indicators for Santa Barbara Health Initiative and the Monterey Santa Cruz Health Authority. And for Medi-Cal providers, SBHI is number one in the state, and Monterey Santa Cruz Central Coast Health Authority is number two overall. And you see these various rates of the HEDIS health data information system. I think it's a national data bank for quality of care indicators, and you can see how they're doing on these specific issues. The task force looked at the various Medi-Cal models. One is a two-plan model, such as they have in San Bernardino County, like they have in Stanislaus County, Riverside County, typically areas where you have a county hospital. There is a commercial plan and a local initiative plan, and essentially the local initiative is a community-developed HMO. We are not a big enough county. As we looked at the pros and cons, we're not a big enough county with 14,000 Medi-Cal beneficiaries to have two plans, to have a commercial plan and a local initiative plan. There isn't the patient base. And the startup costs are probably $3 to $5 million, which in the last round there was money to help, but there's none at this point envisioned. These are the counties with two-plan models, and as I said, most of them have county hospitals. I believe all of them do. Stanislaus, in particular, we reviewed. They're not too far different in size, and their commercial plan did not succeed. It went belly up. So they had a local initiative and then used fee-for-service as your second alternative, and recently have contracted with a commercial plan. They do have almost double the size of the Medi-Cal recipients, though, than we do. Geographic managed care is a system in Sacramento and San Diego, and essentially it's a free-for-all for commercial plans. So San Diego County, a much larger county, for Medi-Cal, there are these five providers. So you've got five plans, and they kind of fight over the patients, and whatever money profit goes to taking the meager Medi-Cal rates, and then they make a profit off it, and they send it to the shareholders, and what's left over is the care they provide. There wasn't a lot of county input in how the system worked. It was truly a free-for-all. There was the one thing that the county could do is say yes or no to whether these plans should be approved to be providers. And therefore, there was some leverage to get some MOUs between public health and the plans. But after the plan was approved, there wasn't any leverage anymore. So that basically says that. County organized health counties, this system, similar to Santa Barbara Health Initiative, has been around. Santa Barbara is the oldest one. Was formed in Santa Barbara's system was founded in 1982, and essentially they have a, when you say county organized, it's up to the county government to say, yes, go ahead and do this, but then it forms a public benefit corporation. And there are federal law limits the number of COHS, community organized, county organized health systems, to five. However, you can expand the existing ones. And so Solano has expanded into Napa and Yolo, and Santa Cruz has expanded into Monterey. And so this is actually the alternative that was proposed in the governor's proposal. And indeed, after we met and looked at all the plans, the task force felt that basically you had much more local control with this, a lot of the current fee-for-service Medi-Cal access and billing issues are resolved by having TARs that are approved within half a day on one side and 2 days on the other, as compared to the state, where it's 10 to 15 days and often sent back with insufficient information provided, please provide more. The county organized health system has been a stable model since 1982 in Santa Barbara. I think in the effort of time, I did not include the slide, but 80-some percent of providers, specialists, are actually participating in Santa Barbara and Santa Cruz. It has a very high participation rate from specialists. Now, whether that would happen in San Luis Obispo County is a $64 million question because there is a shortage of providers. But it this does allow, with Medi-Cal fee-for-service, you can't negotiate rates. You can't sit down and say, well, we don't have enough orthopedists in this town. We'll sign you up for a little, you know, for more than we're paying the standard. Standard base rate is 120% of current Medi-Cal fee-for-service rates, so it is at least a better rate of return than standard Medi-Cal fee-for-service. The recommendation at this point is to say we've reached a point where we think that a COHS is the best alternative. And we don't know yet whether Santa Barbara or the Monterey Santa Cruz model, or whether which of those two organizations would best serve San Luis Obispo County. Now, this board letter has not been officially submitted yet, so it's still in draft form. But the general recommendation is COHS makes sense if we're going in the Medi-Cal managed care area direction, and give us some more time to hammer out some details and deal points so that we can negotiate best with one plan or the other. What would it look like? Obviously, governance is an important issue. Localized offices for provider, member, and health service function, centralized finance, IT, and administrative function, and a name change, and obviously you need to structure it to recognize a lot of local unique characteristics and need of each community. There are several advisory boards working, a provider advisory board, a community advisory board for the current COHSs, both in Santa Barbara and in Santa Cruz. So what would be the next step? You'd have to have a consensus between both county governments, whether it's San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara or San Luis Obispo and Monterey, Santa Cruz. There's a good deal of education of provider and community groups discussion with community groups and provider groups, such as pharmacists. We did provide some information to the Pharmacists Association. But we need to get, you know, what are some of the major issues that we need to try and work to try and leverage this as best we can. And the probably the earliest potential live date is sometime in 2007 or 2008. This is not a quick process if we're as we look at going down this type of path. And that concludes. I believe that's the last. What are the differences between COHSs and commercial plans? Number one, public benefit corporation, and so you're not sending profits to shareholders. You're maintaining the benefit locally. Secondly, people, a lot of individuals who are on Medi-Cal are on Medi-Cal for a long time. As opposed to your commercial plans, one of the bad taste issues of managed care has been the churning that people will move from one, your employer will choose one set of two or three options, and then the next year it'll change, or the price will change, and therefore you have a fiscal incentive to change plans. So one of the experiences in Santa Barbara that's been there since 1982 is they do have the ability to develop a long view, a long-term view. What is it? And we were talking about obesity. It's not worth it to the commercial plans, for the most part, it's not a money maker to put money into obesity prevention, because that plan member is going to be gone in a year or two, as opposed to this kind of a situation where it really makes some sense to do this chronic disease management. And obesity is probably not as clear a model as cost-effective as management of asthma and diabetes. Those are two very clear examples where you put money in up front on chronic disease management, and you incentivize your providers to do a better job in diabetes and asthma management, and you're going to get less hospitalization, you're going to get less disability, and lower health costs. And then you can plow that back into your system in a different, hopefully, I think, a better way. Okay, so this does look at, these are the various specialties and the number of providers that are participating. I think I've said this, and conclusion, COHS makes more sense than the other GMC or two-plan models. Hopefully there would be added value to going in this direction. And that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Are there any questions?
Yes.
Commissioner Pinkel.
Yeah. Well, again, what do we do next? What can the Health Commission at this point do to be helpful?
I don't think that there's any immediate steps here required. We put it down as possible action because, you know, it's always helpful to have the widest options. I think it's premature to say Santa Barbara is the right way to go versus Monterey, Santa Cruz. We haven't gotten a final answer. There was some glimmer of interest from Monterey, Santa Cruz, Central Coast Health Authority as to whether their board of directors was interested in expanding here. And there are probably some natural alignments that would make Santa Barbara attractive in some ways, because there are providers in Santa Maria that might be available, specialists that are available if you can't get specialty panel here. And the Santa Maria River is not a natural boundary. People go across it every day to work and to play and to shop. And so being able to get medical care on that side of the border might not be too bad. So if the commission wants to make a recommendation in terms of, yes, based on the information we've been provided, county organized health system, we agree that it seems to make more sense, that would be fine, or you can take this report tonight and cogitate.
Are you presenting this report also to the Board of Supervisors?
Yes, October 4th, it's on the agenda for presentation and discussion.
Would that be helpful? I'm sorry. Would that be helpful if you had our recommendation and our support before you went to the Board of Supervisors?
I think it's always helpful to have support in that area.
The other thing about Santa Barbara, they have been successful for over 20 years, and you can't beat success.
That's true.
Commissioner Hetherington?
Do you have a feeling of what the medical community's attitude towards this is? I think, didn't this try to fly one other time a few years ago, and it just kind of dropped to the bottom of the lake?
Dr. Hale, were you at the North County Medical Society meeting that Mr. Montoya did the presentation and to the Medical Society group up there?
Yes, I was.
Do you want to give some input to that?
I think the medical community has no idea what to anticipate from this, because if you look at the, 15% of the total cost is physician fees. We have a problem in this county getting consultants, especially physicians, to see patients referred from ERs, from CHC, from private doctor's offices. We have a shortage of specialists in this county, and we don't have a training program at a hospital like they do in Santa Barbara County. So, and I believe they have one in Santa Cruz, too, don't they? Don't they have a regional medical center, so to speak, in Santa Cruz? It's also a training facility, has residency programs there?
I don't believe so.
I don't know. I was thinking they did. Anyway, that's a huge difference between San Luis Obispo County and Santa Barbara County. And so, you know, physicians have really no way to know. One thing they do different in Santa Barbara with regard to ERs is they triage people out of the ER who don't need to be there, but they have a clinic system where they're readily available to see those patients, which we don't have in this county. So there's a number of differences that nobody has an idea of how to predict. Everybody would love to say, yeah, let's do it, because we'll get our specialists to participate at 80% of Medicare. They might be willing to do it in that fashion, but we don't know. So there's a lot of hesitancy. I mean, when you say managed care and Medi-Cal together in the same sentence in a doctor's office, they say, get out of here.
Thanks, Dr.
Hale. That's the truth. That's the truth. But, you know.
No, I lived through the last one, so
yeah, you know, speaking from the ER, I mean, you know, I almost have a conflict of interest, because I think it's going to be a positive thing for us. So, you know, I guess I'd have to say up front that I would probably abstain in any vote that the Health Commission takes.
It's going to be positive for the patient. That's the main thing, I think.
To answer that question, my input on the Medical Society involvement here is that the several representatives have been involved in this task force and have looked at it and have I don't think every again Medi-Cal and managed care in the same sentence probably doesn't entice a lot of involvement. As you look at the statistics, the specialist involvement is pretty low right now. There will be those who are currently seeing some Medi-Cal patients who say, you know, I'm going to get out of this because I don't want to, I want to see how this works before I jump in. But I think overall, they do demonstrate lower hassle factors. Somewhat better reimbursement and much lower hassle factors for taking care of Medi-Cal patients. So I have not seen the same reaction from the medical community that we did 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Thank you. A big concern of mine is that, you know, you have this great program, you present it to the Board of Supervisors, and you have no physician participation. And then where do you go? Thank you.
Commissioner Donnelly?
She echoed my question. That was it. I mean, I think it would be great for the patients, but only if the providers will actually participate in it. And I just wanted, the question that I really had is, how much input have we had from our providers locally into which program they feel is best for us?
That really hasn't, that determination of, you know, I think there's a general feeling that if you're going to go this direction, county organized health system is the way to go. As to, is Santa Barbara a better alternative, or is Central Coast Health Authority better alternative. That's to be determined, and we're continuing the task force with physician involvement, representation of medical society, input of physicians and pharmacists and other providers to try to help make that decision.
Commissioner Horn?
As somebody who worked in managed care for 10 years, what I found over that time frame was education was the most important part of getting a buy-in. I did provider relations, and so I worked hand in glove with physicians all the time. And education was the way that you brought them in. But I also worked for a nonprofit, and so it was a little bit easier for us because we didn't have a board of directors that were looking for a percentage and so on. And so the docs understood that they were getting the best that they were going to get out of their, you know, the reimbursement. The other thing is, it's not just education. It's teaching the docs how to handle their practice in a very cost-effective way. And so many did not do that. Now, this was in Los Angeles. I don't know up here, but in Los Angeles, a lot of them did not do that. And once they were trained into how to handle in a cost-effective way, there were lots of docs that made big bucks. And we had 80% of our patients were Medi-Cal patients. We had some commercial and some Medicare. And we certainly have survived, been around for 25 years. So I'm a big proponent of Medicare, of Medi-Cal managed care, if it's done properly.
Commissioner Hale.
I mean, the point, again, to make with regard to physician input is there's been plenty of input and opportunity. The problem is physicians don't really, I think, understand from a business standpoint exactly where the money is going to be saved, because only 15%, again, is physician fees. 85% is the other business that I think docs don't have that good a handle on. And so they're willing to support it if there's an opportunity to get more of that money back in the physician pool to pay specialists and get more people to participate. So from that standpoint, I think physicians are starting to look at it and say, yeah, maybe there is some potential possibility here, and maybe we will give this a try. But it's one of those things that if it's not flying very well, you're going to have people bailing who won't come back ever. So, I mean, my gut feeling is it's worth the try. I think we're kind of being pushed there. It's a way to bring another few million dollars in from the feds, and I don't think we have, you know, really any other option right now, do we? I mean, do we have the option to say, no, we're not going to play?
The response from the Department of Health Services and the governor's office has been, well, we can't mandate a county organized health system, but we can mandate geographic managed care, which is not a good alternative.
Yes, I think we're going to play.
Does the commission wish to take any further action on this item at this time? Commissioner Hetherington?
Yes, I'd love to move that we support the concept of the COHS in a letter to the Board of Supervisors, hopefully prepared by October 4th.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion is passed unanimously. I'm sorry. The motion is passed with one abstention. Okay, now we are going to move rapidly through the rest of the agenda, which is not very long. And so I will move to the Health Commission updates. I see the chair update is the first update. These are the updates on our various committees that we serve on. So I am a liaison to the Bioterrorism Preparedness Advisory Committee, which I attended their meeting a couple of weeks ago. And I can report that they're continuing with upgrades to their communication system, and that the BT and HRSA grants are providing equipment dealing with a bioterrorist event, and there will be an exercise to test how well we really can respond. And then the other item that I want to report on is the GMO task force, of which I am the chair. And there were two task force meetings since our last Health Commission meeting, one on the 16th of August. At that time, we had a presentation by Mark Phillips on the labeling of GMO foods. We had a brief discussion by Dr. Nancy Reinstein, who's a registered dietitian, on articles that she had forwarded to the committee by email. And we had a large number of guests who spoke about GMO labeling, basically, was what happened to that meeting. It ended up being on that subject. Then we had a meeting on the 6th of September, and we had a presentation by Dr. Steinmaus about how transgenesis is done. And then Dr. Reinstein continued her discussion regarding a specific article by Dr. Schubert. Now, there have been some questions earlier this evening about, see if I can remember them all. First of all, there was a question about what to do about taking a position on an issue. Our understanding and the directions that we received from the Health Commission was that we would not be taking positions on issues. This task force is simply compiling information, and it will make a report. We have invited people who have asked to be make a presentation to our task force to do so. The public is always invited to make their comments, and the information that they bring us will be part of our report in the end. Secondly, Mr. Phillips said that he wanted to have some action on specific legislation that is pending in Sacramento. He would like something from the Health Commission on that. And I directed him to the Legislative Committee. Now, the problem was that we were in between regimes, as it may be, and we didn't have a committee when he was trying to find one. However, we do now have a committee, and the people on that committee received an email from me that said that Mr. Phillips wanted to present his information to them. That's the route that I see as being appropriate. You can correct me if I'm wrong. And that committee would review the legislation and come with this with their recommendation to the Health Commission, which could then consider, just like things this evening, taking action on that. I think I've addressed everything. Yes.
Being a member of the Legislative Committee, I sent an email today to Marcia Bollinger asking her to help me convene a Legislative Committee meeting within the next couple weeks, and I asked for specific legislation that Mr. Phillips had asked about, and also some biomonitoring that we had discussed previously. So it's in the works.
Okay. I guess the only other thing was that Commissioner Hetherington and Commissioner Pinkel voiced concern about what's going on with this committee, and I would like to invite you to attend our next meeting, and maybe that will put your mind at rest. I've had many long conversations with Mr. Phillips, and I really don't have anything further to say on the subject. Our next meeting is, Sarah, when is our next meeting?
Do you recall?
Sorry, I didn't mean to catch you like that. I was thinking I would remember what it was, but I don't. It's like the first. We try to meet prior to the Health Commission meeting so that we can give a report. Also, on next month's, we had discussed as part of our, when we, October 3rd at 4 o'clock at the Health Department. We meet in the sitting room there, at the, what they call it, the large conference room, is that?
The waiting room.
Where we all get sick. Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to mention was that We did talk about having an update in October on the GMO Task Force. The agenda for the next meeting of the GMO Task Force is to address our action plan. Where do we go from here? How do we compile our report? So that is where we are, and that is all I have to say.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to there was some question about, you know, how was the membership selected? There was a committee. Their applications were taken. There was a committee of the health commissioners that included Deborah O'Brien, the prior chair, who has relocated, and I've tried to get in touch with her. Her husband says she's relocated. David O'Dell, Commissioner O'Dell, and Commissioner Hicks. And Commissioner Hicks and O'Dell are not here tonight. Both of them are ill tonight. So that committee, subcommittee of the Health Commission, brought forth the recommended membership of the of that committee, and I believe the Health Commission then approved that and the marching orders of that task force. So at this point, as far as I can see, the task force is running with what their charge was.
I did have one more thing to say about bias. Mrs. Johnson brought that up. She fears that Dr. Steinmaus is biased, but the bias is not part of what goes on at this task force. It's not supposed to be. We're compiling a report. We're not coming out. If indeed we were supposed to be supporting issues, then there might be more of a question about whose side anybody's on. But at this time, nobody's on any – I mean, we're all on the same side, I'm hoping, including – the members of the audience. So I guess that's all I have to say on that. Commissioner Pinkel.
Yeah. Has come up is that the allegation is that I was not accepted as a volunteer as a member of this commission because I had been a supporter of Q. And on the other hand, you have someone on there who is a big anti-Q. And so the people are concerned that there is a double standard.
I understand the concern, but the task force is what it is at this time. But you are very, very welcome to participate, Dr.
Well, I'm not going to attach myself to an existing task force, but I'm saying that this is the allegation that
there was
a selective bias there in favor of the anti-Q position. And again, I'd like to say, you know, I am not against gene transfer. I am favor of regulation of gene transfer, whether it's cloning or human beings, which I am against, but which can happen in this country as long as it's not supported by federal funds. We have no regulation in this country right now on gene transfer, unless you're using federal funds or in a federal institution. And it's chaos. It's the worst possible situation. In England, on the other hand, they do have a national policy, and they have a national council, and no one can do gene transfers unless they go through that council. And I think that's the way it should be. And there was a good suggestion during all of the big controversy, Measure Q, that in our county, we have a committee composed of knowledgeable people as well as a sample of our citizens who would actually pass on and either approve or disapprove of any use of GE in the county. In other words, we would be a mini UK in the sense that we had a system going here. I thought that was a good idea, and that was proposed by someone who was anti-Q. So I think that is it's a good idea, and that would be the way I would go. And right now, it's chaos.
Well, and perhaps that was the expectation of this task force, but that was not – that's not the instructions or the charge that we received. So
maybe you should bring the charge back specifically next month.
Well, I mean, I have it here and I can read it, but it's time is marching on, and that's your choice, I guess. I mean, we can only be here so long. Commissioner Hetherington.
I guess that charge is what I'm going to question, because I know the discussion at the Health Commission was looking at things that had to do with health impacts and studies about health and genetically engineered foods. Now, if the charge changed somewhere along the line, you know.
That's my impression.
And I don't know if the three people that selected the committee changed the commission's charge to begin with.
I think that the mandate became very cloudy. I thought it was clear when I voted in favor of this force, but somehow along the line it got clouded up, and I think it needs to be clarified. And the other thing is that you have no medical researcher on there. You have a good man who is a good botanist, but he's not licensed in health care. He's not familiar with health care. And since the main issues are health, you know, it's very weird.
There is a medical doctor on
but he's a surgeon. He's not a medical researcher. He's never done a gene transfer himself.
Well,
he's never been involved in those kinds of substances that involve gene transfer. I mean, he can't stand up to someone who is a basic scientist who has got familiarity with it but has no health care actual credential.
Well, I think maybe you're looking at a totally different animal. Let me tell you what our charge was given, and I'll read the mission statement. It was to provide the people of San Luis Obispo County with scientifically based information regarding the health implications of genetically engineered foods and crops. The goals were to gather reviewed scientific information on genetically engineered foods and crops, e.g. health effects, epidemiological studies, product labeling, and marketing. Two, to conduct liaison with health officer, Ag Commission, Supervisor Bianchi, and other appropriate agencies and entities regarding genetically engineered food and crops. To work with the Education Committee of the Health Commission to provide educational opportunities to the public on this topic. To update the Health Commission on the current status of the task force findings at 4, 8, 12 months as appropriate. A final report will be presented for consideration to the full Health Commission, setting forth scientific information, pro and con, on the subject of genetically engineered foods, crops, from the perspective of the health considerations and implications. To take no position, pro or con, as to whether the county should have legislation on genetically engineered food and crops. So in our first meeting, we felt that the thing to do was to identify the concerns in the community about genetically engineered foods and then go from there. And that's what we did. That's where we started.
I guess I'm not being clear because I'm not getting my message through. You have no one on there who is familiar with gene transfer and its effects on humans. And you have no one on there who has any experience in medical research. And how can you draw this data together or reach any conclusions of any kind unless you've got someone in there that knows the medical science, not just the agronomic science? And this is where you are lacking.
Well, I heard what you said, but I didn't select the members, and the task force is as it is. And
I know,
if you think that you're that person, we would love to have you come and participate.
No, that's not the point. I'm saying that, you know, you say that you are going to do this, but you're not equipped to do that. And, you know, I don't need to intrude on it. In fact, I wouldn't think of it at this point. But you need to get someone. And there are such people around, and you could use them, that person as a resource person.
That would be great. Could you give me the names of who those people are?
Oh, I can find them for you. You have.
That would be good.
Not in this county.
Probably. Well, that's okay. We're interested in talking to people. They don't have to be from this county to give presentations to this task force that can help us with our final report.
If you have
the names of people who are willing to come and do that, we would welcome hearing from them.
If Fair enough.
Okay. Thank you. Could we move on now? Thank you very much. It's kind of awkward being the chair of this commission and the chair of that task force. I was the chair of the task force before I knew I was going to be the chair of the commission. So that's, but I felt that I would had started with it, so I wanted to continue. Okay, commissioner update. Let's just start down at the bottom of the table with Commissioner Hale.
I don't have anything to update.
All right, Commissioner Warren.
Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board meeting is still working on some platform statements and discussion around binge drinking and the issues that are involved there.
Thank you. Commissioner Pinkel? Commissioner Schmusis?
I attended the Adult Services Policy Council meeting on September 9th, and we had a very informative presentation from William Pate. I hope that's how he pronounces his last name, from HICAP, regarding the Medicare prescription drug legislation that's coming down the pike. It's not going to be pretty, and I would like to the commission to entertain having Mr. Pate come, or Dr. What is he? He's about six times retired from everything. Come and present to the council. He has some wonderful information, a very easy to follow program on an issue that is not easy to understand and get your arms around. So that's my update.
Thank you. Commissioner Horn?
I was unable to attend CSN in August, but I plan to be there in September.
Mr. Massey?
Nothing to update.
Massey. Commissioner Donnelly?
I will be the liaison to the HIV Care Consortium, and I have nothing to report at this time.
Thank you. Commissioner Hetherington?
I missed the SLOCAP meeting this morning, but they did supply me with minutes, and I'm happy to announce that they received a grant for $73,000 to help booster their budget and their great programs.
Okay. Next month, we were focusing on seniors. We were going, when we talked about what programs we wanted to have, we talked about having a presentation on the Medicare D program. I think that Commissioner Schmusis' suggestion that we contact this program manager for HICAP and see if we can have him come talk to us is great. The other couple of things that are on here, it says senior issues, so that will be revealed to us what the senior issues are. Dr. Thomas?
There is an evolving issue that I think the Health Commission, there's been a request that there be some time on the agenda, hopefully in October. French Hospital reduced the number of, actually they, in mid-August, declared a moratorium on doing any dental surgery on children. And they restarted that, I think, on September 1st at a very limited number, down from 40, 45 a month to 12 a month. There's an acute issue of how to take care of children with extensive dental problems that need some kind of anesthesia or sedation to take to resolve. And there's been a request to bring that to the Health Commission so there's more public awareness and see whether there's any input the Health Commission can do to bring people together to work on this.
Are they doing dentals at Sierra?
They have some. They're doing some on disabled adults. When General Hospital closed, they took on a number of the developmentally disabled adults for dental surgery. They have not been doing children historically.
So we would be hearing a report from French Hospital or from
Most likely be from the CHDP staff who are trying to arrange dental surgeries and from one or two of the pediatric dentists about the issue and potential next steps.
Okay.
It is a huge problem for the clinic, the dental clinic up in North County. They just the kids are so bad with the problems that they have, and you can't do that in the office. I mean, it's not the best way. It's got to go into surgery, and so it's a bad situation.
Yes, it is.
The other item that we had was environmental issues. We thought we would discuss those in October. Does anybody have any thoughts on what environmental issues we might like to bring up?
Chair Enza, I would suggest that we move the environmental issues down to water quality.
Okay.
And I think, you know, an update on the sludge ordinance, I think the sewage spill in Slow Creek is a good one. I think maybe having a representative from the Regional Water Quality Control Board would be a good idea. And, you know, Kurt Batson from Environmental Health to tell us how many beach closures we've had in the recent past. Those are just to name a few.
And I think that those things all go together well. So that would make a good agenda in November. So we'll deal with senior issues, the dentals, and update from the GMO Task Force.
One more potential, and that is CHC has completed their year of service, and they came forth with an annual report. And so you need to, at some point, agendize a presentation of the annual report.
Okay. We can probably do that.
Could we get copies of that report before we discuss it?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, and then, oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner.
Yeah, they did present that report at the Adult Services Policy Council. It was quite interesting.
How long was it?
It was manageable.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so the other thing that I need to mention is that we will be meeting on the 17th of October because the 10th of October is a county holiday. And if that is agreeable to all the commissioners, that is when we will have our meeting. Any questions on that?
And
Dr. Thomas?
We have a new location.
Oh, yes, and we have a new location. We're going to meet in the Board of Supervisors chambers. How many chambers are there?
We have a new location. That is across the street in the new county building.
I would like to reserve a cushy chair for the next meeting.
These chairs weren't bad. All right.
You're sitting in David Edge's chair.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
I move to that we adjourn.
This meeting is...
That's fine. Whoops. I was just going to give you information on the County Medical Society had a presentation at one of its meetings with regard to Part D Medicare II, and so they might have some resources of people to talk to. So give Kay Mickelson a call at the County Medical Society.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.